One of today's sponsors, SunsetLakeCBD.com. This is a great company, and I have to say, I have become a CBD believer. CB believer? CDB, CDB believer. First of all, Sunset Lake CBD, they started out as a dairy farm up in Burlington, Vermont, and they diversified. In 2018, they were given the dairy for Ben and Jerry's. They diversified, started growing CBD with the help of University of Vermont and practicing regenerative farming practices. They have great business practices, $15 minimum wage. Company is owned, majority of owners are employees. They 100% pesticide free. They use integrated pest management, which is basically they introduce natural predators to different bugs and whatnot. They're 100% organic in their fertilizer. And the bottom line is that the CBD, all of their products are really honestly fantastic. The tincture I use quite a bit for sleeping and I guess some rather stressful times with my kids and whatnot. The salve that they have, the CBD salve with arnica, I use for me personally. I use it for my eczema, but folks have had great response to it in terms of their arthritis or their sore muscles. They have gummy bears. They have CBD infused coffee, which is delicious and sort of interesting. Takes some of the edge off of that caffeine. It's my weekend brew. And then they have these smokables. And I've tried them a little bit. Matt, why don't you speak to the smokables?
The smalls are where I'm at these days. The nice little buds that are sort of pre-broken off the stem that you can stick right into your grinder. I think people will know how convenient that is if you know what I know. So
it's really an interesting experience with I've tried a couple of the pre-rolls and you get that sort of like, I don't know, physical mellow in some weird way, but you don't have the psychoactive part about it. SunsetLakeCBD.com. You get 20% off if you use the coupon code LEFT IS BEST. One word, LEFT IS BEST. SunsetLakeCBD.com. They're fans of the show. They wanted to use LEFT IS BEST as the coupon code. So there it is. Yeah. 20% off. Check it out. Also, thanks to this week's sponsor, Future Hindsight. If you're looking for a podcast that promotes civic engagement, gives listeners inspiration and actionable tips to stay engaged, and believes a better future is just around the corner, look no further. Their current season focuses on rebuilding America after COVID. Highly recommend you check it out. Future Hindsight is available wherever you listen to podcasts or futurehindsight.com. Now for this show.
Every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday. Tuesday, casual Tuesday. Wednesday, casual hump day. Thursday, casual Thurs. That's what we call it. And Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, December 4th, 2020. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, Brandon Sutton, Francesca Fiorentini will be here. Meanwhile, to placate Trump, at his rally tomorrow in Georgia, Georgia Governor Kemp calls for an audit of an already certified election. Meanwhile, Georgian Secretary of State Raffensperger goes after registration groups. COVID breaks another record. California on the verge of a shelter-at-home order. New York's positivity rate is at a six-month high. Joe Biden calls for 100 days of mask wearing. Meanwhile, the economy has stalled as millions now are long-term unemployed. Pressure builds on Mitch McConnell. Calls for COVID relief become desperate. And the Republicans in the House try to adjourn. Report Trump is considering up to 20 preemptive pardons. Gina Raimondo out of HHS contention. Murthy and Fauci are on President-elect Biden's COVID team. The National Labor Relations Board says Google interfered with workers' labor organizing. The chair of the Florida Democratic Party resigns after those devastating 2020 losses in Florida. New York Times reports the FBI used the Patriot Act to collect logs from websites you have all visited. All this and more on today's program, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome. Say hello to Emma Viglin. Hello, Emma. How are you?
Hello, Sam. Doing right. Oh, doing right. Yeah.
Doing so, right. Well, okay. That's good. I'm glad to hear that. It's better than
doing
wrong.
Good, like Superman.
All right. Well, there it is. We got a lot to talk about today. We're slowly getting to the post-Trump era, although Trump is trying to make that era as elongated as possible. So we don't have one of those sort of like massive Donald Trump stories this week. Although tomorrow he's heading to Georgia, and you can see the ripple effects. And we're going to be talking about this with Brandon, because Trump is heading to Georgia tomorrow for a rally, and now we're seeing the tribute that the governor of Georgia and the secretary of state of Georgia are offering the president, so as not to continue on saying that the Georgia election was rigged, and therefore implying that January 5th's runoff is going to be rigged. We had reported yesterday on the most recent polling in Georgia, which has the race very, very tight, both of the races very, very tight. And so the idea that, you know, even a small percentage of Republican voters will stay at home because they don't believe that this election can be fair has big implications. But before we get to that with Brandon, we are at the sort of front end of a growing and, at this point, unavoidable, real desperate tragedy with COVID following, you know, in the wake of Thanksgiving. We're seeing the numbers grow every day. We are on the brink in many places of overrunning the hospitals. In some places, it's already happened. But in terms of like widespread failure, that's why we're hearing in California talk of a more or less a statewide lockdown, because their hospitals, not unlike in New York, where we had Andrew Cuomo shrink the public hospital system over the past decade by 10 to 20%. In addition, California, in a similar situation, the public hospital system has shrunk. You also have a shrinking of, or a consolidation of, the private hospital system, because you've got these major hospital medical companies coming in. They're consolidating them. They're cutting out supposedly, you know, the fat. And the fat is extra capacity in when you need it in times like these. Now, of course, pandemics are not, they don't happen very often. However, we have hospitalizations. And if anybody knows any nurses or hospital staff, if you're friendly with any of them, they undoubtedly, you have heard stories of how they are expecting more and more out of nurses just prior to the pandemic, out of nurses, out of staffs, because these corporations come in, And for them, it's about the bottom line. It is profits above all. And they are trying to squeeze as much as they can out of it with as little margin, with as little cushion as possible, with slack in the system.
Yeah, that's why we were so ill-prepared. One of the many reasons we were so ill-prepared beyond the Trump administration cutting the pandemic response team prior to a pandemic, the one that Obama put in place, but also the fact that we have a for-profit healthcare system. The margins were already, you know, very slim and thin in order to enrich the people at the top and make sure costs were low. But the fact that they're continuing to do so as we're living through COVID, I think says a lot about the healthcare that's provided by the private sector.
Right. And so this is, we're on the brink of this. Joe Biden, in talking about essentially putting together his medical team, if you will, medical advisors, I don't recall ever a time in the past where we have paid this much attention to who's going to be the president's medical advisors in the context of a transition, but obvious for obvious reasons, we're doing so now. And one of the things he said is he's going to ask when he gets, after he gets inaugurated, for Americans to spend 100 days wearing a mask. And I think the idea is in his mind, and it appears that that's when there will be widespread availability of a vaccine within 100 days of his inauguration. And on the right, in the mouthpiece for the Republican Party, even on their sort of like genteel show in the morning, Fox and Friends, they are still sort of like expressing some type of skepticism. This is a fascinating clip because we've mentioned in the past that one of the people on Fox and Friends, Steve Doocy, seems to be the only one who really actually is very concerned about COVID.
Although he can't show his concern as expressly as he wants to, he's kind of a cuck to the rest of the other.
Well, you can hear this. You can hear this. You can hear him in the background of this clip.
The days of being sheep are over. People want to go down with a fight. That's the American spirit. Number one, the president-elect, if he becomes president of the United States, cannot mandate masks for 50 states. 37 states already have mask mandates. Nobody's going to make you put a mask on in your car or sit alone on the beach or in your backyard. So good luck with that. We're already doing almost
already
everything
doing
they told
that.
Us to. Yeah,
to
we're already doing it.
I don't go to any grocery store without
nobody,
everyone has a mask on.
Nobody does. And so I don't know what he's talking about. Out because the election's over as they try to find out what actually happened.
Okay.
You guys are in New York and there's a mask mandate put in place by the governor there. And that's why everybody wears masks in New York.
It is stunning how I don't know if these guys are pretending not to realize what's been going on around the country. If they haven't seen any of the clips they've played of Donald Trump's rallies, if they haven't, of the protests at these, you know, all of these protests about their, about the, you know, the supposed vote rigging. And you can hear Doocy in the background keep going, but I mean, they are determined. And the idea is like, I mean, what's also fascinating is that the theory that, Kilmeade is pushing here is that Biden's only talking about this because of the election. And then his response to Biden still talking about it well after the election. Remember, these are the same people who told you that on November 4th, all this was going to go away,
yeah.
Right? Because this was just a stunt. And now his response is, why are you still talking about this? The election's over. He is forgetting the fact that it's his own straw man as to why people were concerned about COVID, not an actual political agenda. And the idea that they would just refer to it that way, they are telling millions of people that watch their shows that this is overblown, that the mask compliance is not an issue when of course it is.
And the idea that Biden telling people to wear masks, something literally 0% of people enjoy, would be some political boon to him, would be some sort of success story and some way for him to win over voters. What are you talking about? The whole reason Trump tried to avoid a mask mandate or an encouragement by himself of the American people to wear masks was because he wanted to pretend everything was okay and live in a fairy tale world. And he knew that asking people to put cloth over their face and it's not that comfortable. Wow, it's not the best political strategy. Biden's trying to do it so that we can tide ourselves over and stop with these massive deaths over and over, the numbers keeping going up until we're able to get to a place where a vaccine is available fairly widely.
Indeed. All right, we're going to take a break. We'll be back in just a moment with Brandon Sutton. Folks, this episode, as well as my breakfast, sadly, I killed the box.
Magic spoon, none for me anymore?
I'm sorry. I've already got more cinnamon on the way. Nice. But as you remember, breakfast cereal, one of the favorite parts of being a kid, all that sugary goodness in that milk after you're done. Maybe it was the fruity colors in there. Maybe it was the chocolate. For me, it was always the chocolate. Of course, as you get older, you realize there's a problem with that because all that sugary goodness is actually sugary not goodness. It is not good for you. However, Magic Spoon has figured out a way to relive the magic of your childhood cereal in a much healthier way. Magic Spoon comes with 0 grams of sugar, 11 grams of protein, only 3 net grams of carbs in each serving. And now, because of popular demand, you can finally build your very own custom variety box. They ship it to you in a box of 4. So you can choose from the best-selling cocoa, fruity, frosted, and blueberry flavors, plus brand new flavors, including peanut butter and cinnamon. I have to say, those two are my favorite. And the cocoa. And sometimes I'm not afraid to admit that I'm not above mixing the peanut butter and the cocoa.
Ooh, just because, chocolate and peanut butter.
Yes, of course.
Always good.
Of course. It tastes amazing. And honestly, it is too good to be true. For me, it's almost my daily breakfast snack, although what I've been doing now lately is I just sort of nibble on them as I'm preparing for the show. But I killed that box yesterday morning, and I'm waiting for more. But it's also, I find myself at home in the middle of the night, then I'll have a little snack.
Yum.
Yeah. And my kids love it. And it's not bad for them. It's keto friendly. It's gluten free. It's grain free. It's soy free. It's low carbon. It's GMO free. Folks, go to magicspoon.com/majority report. You can build your own custom variety box and try it today. Be sure to use our promo code Majority Report at checkout to get free shipping. Magic Spoon is so confident, it's backed with a 100% happiness guarantee. So if you don't like it for any reason, they'll refund your money, no questions asked. That's magicspoon.com/majority report. Use the code Majority Report for free shipping. Thank Magic Spoon for sponsoring the podcast and my breakfast. Also, you know, we were talking about 230, Section 230 yesterday. And one of the big problems, from my perspective, is the tracking of your data by a lot of these websites that you visit. And it happens with ISPs. And frankly, we had that story about Section 215 with logs today.
Yeah.
The same company who controls half of online retail also eavesdrops on your conversations at home passively. We know that big tech is more powerful than many countries are, frankly, and they are profiting by exploiting on your personal data. You want to put a layer of protection between your online activity and these tech juggernauts? ExpressVPN. ExpressVPN hides your IP address, something that big tech companies use to identify you. ExpressVPN makes your activity harder to trace and sell to advertisers. It also encrypts 100% of your internet data and keeps you safe from hackers, keep you safe from any eavesdroppers on your network. ExpressVPN does all this without slowing your connection, does it with an easy one click. It's rated the number one VPN service by CNET and Wired. All you got to do is you download the app. You download it to your phone. You download it to your computer. You can download it to your tablet. Mm-hmm. And you tap one button, you are protected as you are surfing the web. You can stop handing over your personal data to the big tech monopoly that mines your activity and sells your information. Protect yourself with the VPN that I trust to keep me safe online. Visit expressvpn.com/majority. That's expressvpn, E-X-P-R, ESSVPN.com/majority to get 3 extra months free. Go to ExpressVPN.com/majority right now to learn more. And also, lastly, one of the things that, you know, folks are dealing with, obviously, during COVID, having maybe your parents, your grandparents isolated, and you want to keep them safe. You don't want them going to the supermarket to buy food. You don't want them to going out to eat. Months ago, my sisters and I started sending my mom freshly dinners and meals. And we didn't want her, she would not have accepted it from us paying for it, except for I told her that we were advertising it and they were giving it all to me for free. And, you know, she would say, like, this stuff is great. I'm telling all my friends so that and then they started advertising with us. So
there you go.
I am no longer fibbing to my mom, but I'm sure, mom, if you're listening, you understand why we did that, because you wouldn't have accepted it. But Freshly is delicious. It's good food. It's healthy. And it's at a very, very reasonable price. And it's so easy. All you have to do is heat it for 3 minutes. Dinner is done. You don't have to go to the grocery store. You don't have to worry about it. For me, it's super helpful. Once or twice a week, I will have a Freshly meal for my kids and I. It's like home cooking without actually having to do the home cooking.
Right.
And one of the things that's super convenient about this, and I should say, it's all fresh. It is not frozen. And it's delivered right to your door. One of the things that's super convenient about it is you can order it online, but you can also do it on the app. And you got over 30 delicious, better for you meals. Like, they got the, like a steak peppercorn. There's like a chicken risotto. There is like a sausage pasta that Saul likes, but the app for me is really good because I always am thinking, like, when I'm walking home, what am I going to make for dinner tonight? Mm-hmm. And I'm like, tomorrow I'm going to get Freshly, or, you know, Thursday I'm going to get Freshly, and I can do it as I'm walking home.
Oh, wow.
I can
it's
do
that
it on
quick.
The app. It's well, it delivered to you within days.
Nice.
So join almost 1.5 million satisfied customers. Skip the shopping, prepping, cooking, and cleanup. Freshly is offering our listeners $40 off your first two orders at freshly.com/majority. That's freshly.com/majority. Okay, let's welcome to the program Brandon Sutton. He is the co-host of the blog The Discourse, and he is a pretty bad lefty on Twitter. Brandon, you here? Do we have him?
I am here. Can you hear me?
Yes, Brandon. Welcome back to the show. Emma Viglin is here with me.
Hey, Brandon.
Hey, it's a pleasure to join you both. I do have to offer a correction, though, Sam. I'm the co-host of the podcast, The Discourse. There is also a blog called The Discourse, I believe, that's run by the former writers from Deadspin and a few other Gizmodo groups.
Did I not say the podcast?
You might have. Actually, I wasn't listening, but, you know, just in case. I like to make sure people know that they're different, distinct things.
Okay. No, you said the blog.
I did say the blog?
Yep.
I've never blogged.
Jack writes for the blog.
Okay. Well, I don't know why I would ever say the co-host of a blog. That's weird. But nevertheless, you're the co-host of the podcast, The Discourse. Let's get right into this, okay? I want to talk about Georgia starting off, because the implications of this election in Georgia are huge. In part because, I mean, look, the control of the Senate is obviously a big deal, but with a margin this slim, the opportunity, the Biden administration is going to get basically one bite at the apple to try and provide some relief to the economic, you know, a tsunami, I think, that we're going to hit at the end of this year and at the beginning of 2021, as we have 12 million people who are getting off of unemployment. We have millions who are long-term unemployed now. We're starting to see the unemployment numbers go up. To the extent that we saw the rate drop, that's just a function of people leaving the job market. We're going to see evictions. And there's no reason to believe, like, you know, we have all of these businesses that have closed. We need stimulus. And it's not going to be, we're months and months away from folks, and we can talk more about COVID, but we're months and months away from like getting back to any type of normalcy, probably a year away from that. And this Georgia election, we have these Republicans who are fighting with each other as to whether they should go out and vote at this point. It's sort of fascinating.
No, I agree. I think it's, you know, I want to, if they're looking for my opinion, they shouldn't go out and vote, you know, but I don't know if I'm legally allowed to say that. If I'm legally allowed to like discourage people from voting. You'll let me know, after, I assume. Yeah, no, I mean, I think that when going into 2020 is never going to end though. You want the Democrats to be put in the best position possible to help people if that's what they want to do. You want to sort of have the ball in their court, regardless of whether or not you, at least in my opinion, think that they are going to do it, right? Because ultimately, I think that it's a much better chance that if they control the Senate and the House, we see a lot more, you know, we see a lot more movement. Although Nancy Pelosi has come out on stimulus today and said that it's okay to have a smaller relief package, you know, because Biden's going to be president. So there's, you know, there's reason to worry that them having majority in the Senate won't lead to that. But, you know, I think that it's a good litmus test, right, for whether or not we have to continue to work with the Democratic Party entirely or whether or not we have to sort of start cutting our ties early.
Well, I want to play that clip in just a moment. But I mean, it seems to me that if the Democrats manage to get to a 50-50 place in the Senate, there's basically only one massive bite at the apple they will have. And that will be to pass a stimulus through reconciliation. And then basically after that, you're going to have to go to Joe Manchin if you ever want anything else. And not just Joe Manchin. I mean, if they win, Ossoff, Warnock, Kelly in Arizona, King to a certain extent. I mean, these are all going to be roadblocks to getting some real, you know, progressive legislation. But in reconciliation for a stimulus, that's going to be it. But you mentioned Nancy Pelosi. This is really just shocking because, and we've talked, well, let's play this clip. This is Nancy Pelosi today. I just want to remind people, in April of this year, the Democrats passed a second tranche of the PPP. And when the Republicans came back because they wanted more, I think they wanted $230 billion worth. The Democrats said we want closer to $400 billion worth of PPP. We want to make sure that it's there's more access for people who don't have banking relationships. That was fine. But there was a lot of people, including Andrew Cuomo, who said you need to get funding for states and cities in this. And when she was questioned on it, because that was the last time people perceived she would have a leverage. When she was questioned on it, she just went ballistic and told people they had no idea what they were talking about. She guaranteed we're going to get state and municipal funding. Here we are 8 months later, and we do not have that. Let's play this clip today.
If you are on the precipice of getting a coronavirus deal and you can't, if you are on the precipice.
Really on before that.
Okay. But what shifted, in your opinion, when the Problem Solvers Caucus had a much larger bill a few months ago? You did not like that piece of legislation. What has shifted now when they're on board with this piece that's come out of the Senate?
Perhaps you missed what I said earlier. Joe Biden committed to ending and crushing the virus and having a Build Back America initiative, Build Back Better, a vaccine. Answer to our prayers, an answer to our prayers of 95% effectiveness in terms of Pfizer and Moderna, and there may be others coming forward. Now that is a total game changer, a new president and a vaccine. So there's nothing to, these are different. What was then before was not more of this. This has simplicity. It's what we've had in our bills. It's for a shorter period of time. But that's okay now because we have a new president, a president who recognizes that we need to depend on science to stop the virus, a president who understands that America's working families need to have money in their pockets in a way that takes them into the future without any of the contraptions of any of the other bills that the administration was associating itself with them before. We feel very excited about the prospect that there's a bipartisan bill, because I told members I'm not bringing any more bills that are not bipartisan. We wanted to show what needs to be done.
Okay. She contradicted herself there, though, because she's supportive of this $902 billion bipartisan bill that does not have $1,200 checks. And she says Biden understands. Biden's saying that that bill is not good enough. And Pelosi's basically backing it as a smaller bill, right? So, one, does the virus put money or does the vaccine put money in people's pockets? I don't think so. A vaccine that's going to be available to them in June, does that pay the rent? I don't understand. It was incoherent.
That was incoherent. Brandon, let me hear your take on that.
Well, frankly, Sam, I don't believe in science. And so I'm going to come out as, you know, in strict opposition to that. You know, I think it's, you know, we're seeing, in my opinion, at least a light framing of this vaccine as a magic bullet. Even as people who are more familiar with virology and epidemiology are saying, well, you know, people are still going to have to social distance after they get the vaccine. People are still going to need to, you know, adhere to various self-isolation rules after they get the vaccine, because we don't know enough about the virus yet. You know, on the other side, we have the Democrats coming out and saying, well, now that we have a new president, Joe Biden, and the vaccine is on the way, we'll be able to return to normalcy. And that theoretic return to normalcy is going to be the solution to not only the virus, but also all of the economic consequences that the virus has already, you know, put in place. People are already being evicted. People are already, you know, eating through their savings. People have already done those things. And, you know, even if the vaccine is 100% effective, it's not going to be the silver bullet to what's going to happen as a result of coronavirus.
Yeah, it's absolute insanity to me. I mean, you know, listen, I understand this is, she needs to have a story here, and the story needs to explain why she did not sign on to the $1.5 trillion problem solver stimulus that was proposed in September, because ostensibly that was too small at the time. Why she did not agree to the $1.8 trillion bill proposed by the Trump administration, even if that was like completely empty and was smoke and mirrors. Had she said, okay, I'll sign on to that, and it gone to the Senate and there was nothing there, or Mitch McConnell didn't want to vote on it and had blocked it, that would have had political value. The problem is that Nancy Pelosi was insistent upon protecting her power within the caucus by protecting the agendas of all her committee chairs over providing this relief. And maybe it was a good calculation, because they thought passing this relief would have helped Donald Trump, and maybe Donald Trump would have won. But she doesn't have a good story now. No. The idea, and it's not just that it's a bad story in that it's not sufficiently explaining those decisions. It is setting up, if we win those two races, the Democrats in Georgia, and Joe Biden does have the ability to pass a larger bill, you're going to have Republicans pointing to Nancy Pelosi saying, Nancy Pelosi 4 weeks ago said we didn't need anything more than $900 billion.
And how bad at politics do you have to be to, when your party is now in power in the House and the executive branch, to push for a smaller stimulus without checks that could be, you know, signed by Joe Biden? In the way, well, he would never do that. But people credited Trump for those stimulus checks politically, because they were like, oh, I'm getting a $1,200 check in the mail and Trump gave it to me.
But I mean, Brandon, let me ask you this, because I don't fault Pelosi for pushing a $900 billion bill right now, because there is no leverage. All the leverage was given away months and months ago. What I fault is the Democrats for not recognizing that their leadership has failed them. And what we're looking at now is an example of failed leadership.
Well, I think those two things are actually connected, right? I agree with you. I think this is an example of failed leadership. And I think, you know, ultimately, you can fault the Democrats for being in the position they are now because people were yelling at them when they were giving up this leverage back months ago that this is what's going to happen, right? And the reason why they are capable of obscuring this fact is because of the very precariousness that this, you know, finding themselves in this situation lends itself to. If everyone is so precarious, if this new stimulus, if this new sort of like injection to the economy only lasts for 2 or 3 months, then there's only so much people can plan forward into the future. There's only so much time you can spend thinking about replacing the Dems if you theoretically need them to be constantly fighting in this kind of cycle for scraps. And I think so. I think precariousness is the point. I think they don't want to condition people to be too comfortable with getting, you know, basic needs met without employment. They don't want to keep people from being tethered to their in jobs due to health insurance. So, I mean, I think now what we're seeing is the danger of a Biden presidency when it comes to getting things done for coronavirus, right? That there are going to be a lot of excuses why it can't be done. And the Republicans are going to be able to turn those excuses into weapons in a way that Democratic Party failed to do for Trump. Right. Because I think that the Republican Party is not going to be as generous as the Democratic Party was. They're going to make, you know, they're going to tie Biden around the neck of the Democrats in the Senate. And then we'll see, you know, we'll see another loss in 2022 in the Senate and House. And then, you know, they'll have another excuse for why they can't do things. And so I think that we have to be more comfortable as a people with saying, okay, yeah, but finding yourself in a situation where all you can do is argue for like a month's worth of, you know, local and state business loan, Pell Grant offshoots because you've given up all your leverage is a fatal flaw in a leader.
Let's play a second clip from Nancy Pelosi during this press conference. I mean, because really I think the argument here, and I think you guys have restated it fairly, is that because Joe Biden is here and he's taking coronavirus seriously, all of this economic hardship is going to go away.
Well, he restored the soul of America, so you're not going to get evicted now.
Well, I just don't understand that. Let's play this clip.
Yeah.
Was it a mistake to have to accept half of a loaf months ago when you said, I'm not going to accept half a loaf?
Look, I'm going to tell you something. Don't characterize what we did before as a mistake, as a preface to your question, if you want an answer. That was not a mistake. It was a decision, and it has taken us to a place where we can do the right thing without other, shall we say, considerations in the legislation that we don't want. Now, that is it. Now, the fact is, I'm very proud of where we are.
Can somebody tell me, I mean, I can guess at one of the other considerations, right? That is presumably the blanket immunity for corporations and the way that they treat their workers from lawsuits and I guess presumably also consumers. Now, my understanding is that there's a 6-month moratorium in this $900 billion bill, which 6-month moratorium, I don't think it's terribly problematic as long as there's not a clock ticking on these claims. But is there anything else that you're aware of that are supposedly these other considerations? And if they're so bad, why wouldn't you tell us?
I mean, I can't think of any other consideration that, and even if there were some, I would think that they should be laid out for us, right? As people, they should be laid out unless there's some kind of like rule of secrecy.
Politics. Do politics. If they were real, hammer the Republicans on them.
Right. I mean, if there are considerations in this Mitch McConnell proposal or there's considerations in the Trump proposal as to that it somehow inhibited the value of the stimulus, why would you not talk about that and use it against your political opponents?
Well, because that'd be rude. And so instead, you know, that kind of burden, no, I mean, that burden is off shifted onto the voters. You know, we're being expected, the Democratic Party voters are being expected to just sort of have blind trust that Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden are doing, you know, what they're supposed to be doing. And that, you know,
that's in her answer there too, implicit. It's just such an arrogant reaction. Like, that wasn't a mistake. That was a decision. Okay. You realize that mistakes can also be decisions. Those are not polar opposites of each other.
Most of my mistakes are decisions I once made.
It's just so obvious that she's trying to deflect from the fact that she said back in October or whatever, when Mnuchin was trying to offer her $1.8 trillion, and you could have given that to Mitch McConnell and have him say no to it. Have him say no to it if you were so sure that it wasn't going to get passed, right? Like, she has to cover, when at the time she said, oh, it's because there isn't enough of a national testing strategy. That bill had $1,200 checks, that agreement had $1,200 checks that had state and local funding. It had all of those things that she's saying she cares about now. But now that Biden is president, well, that must mean that half of that loaf, literally half of the $1.8 trillion agreement that you were talking about, that must mean it's better because your standards shift based on who is in power. It's so inconsistent and gross. I don't know.
I guess I'm frustrated at the complete lack of accountability that seems within. I mean, we just had the Democratic chair of Florida resign because of how badly they did in Florida. There is no doubt that the Democratic leadership in the House and the Senate, when it comes to both the politics and, you know, the politics of the policies and the politics of electoral politics, at the very least, had no, you know, you could make the argument that, well, there was a certain inevitability that Democrats weren't going to pick up any seats in the or going to pick up the Senate. They still may, that they were going to lose in the House. But certainly the leadership wasn't aware of that. I mean, these people are the professionals. This is their job. And none of it has gone in the way that they predicted it. We haven't got the state and municipal funding that Pelosi predicted, and now she's saying we don't need it. We didn't pick up 10 seats in the House.
We lost.
Didn't pick up, exactly.
It's going to be 5-7 seat majority for Democrats, which, spoiler alert, means it's likely that Republicans backlash and take the House in 2022. I have no faith in Pelosi and Democratic leadership to retain the House into 2022.
Well, no, I agree. And I mean, honestly, these losses, like Sam alluded to earlier, they'll just be presented as inevitable. Because it's a two-party system, because no one else is ever allowed to try the reins of the party, they can frame every loss as just simply what had to happen and no one could have possibly done better. And if, you know, if we had done something else, we would have just lost more, right? That, you know, that's been the response to the criticism of third-way Democratic Party politics for as long as I can remember, where like, well, yeah, we may have lost 1,000 seats, but if we'd done the other thing, we would have lost even more. And, right. You know, the lack of ability to ever, you know, demand that we try something new or, you know, at least turn over reins to new ideas just ensures that people just become conditioned, I think, to believing that, yeah, like, this is the best we can do. I think the Democratic Party politics, at least, you know, their ideology that they portray for their voter is very fatalistic. They just think that, like, they are always saying that this is the best we can do. We can never do any better. Everyone else is always going to be, you know, basically trash voters, and only like our core voting Democratic Party politic class is good enough to understand the true nature of like the way the world should work, which is as whatever Nancy Pelosi says is right is right. And I think we're seeing that. I think we're going to see that brush up on its limits once people, you know, coronavirus is only getting worse. You know, you have somebody who's the head of the party coming out and saying the vaccine is going to be some kind of magic bullet, or at least alluding to that, as we enter a winter that most epidemiologists are going to say are, you know, using very, very vague but menacing words to describe. So, you know, I think that that's going to be the recipe for a lot of people, you know, having a come to Jesus moment with the Democratic Party.
Well, I hope you're right, but what I'm really more concerned about is, you know, Nancy Pelosi has a vote for the Speaker of the House, and that is coming up presumably in January once the new Congress is installed, and there should be concessions. I mean, because we saw on day one attacks on supposedly, I guess, you know, activists in the streets as a reason as to why Democrats lost. Then it was because AOC has too many Twitter followers, and that's why Democrats lost. Listen to here's what Katie Porter had to say yesterday about this COVID relief. And tell me if this message, I think is incredibly poignant from Katie Porter, if that is consistent with what the leader of the Democrats in the House said today.
One of the things that's making me really frustrated right now is when I hear people talk about this as stimulus. Let's be clear. It is not stimulus money to give people money so they can feed themselves, so that they can keep heat on in the winter, so that they can avoid eviction. That's not stimulus. That is basic needs that we're talking about meeting. And you're absolutely right that it's not enough to just do some unemployment. It's not enough to do more with food assistance. People need that direct assistance. And all of the research on this, interestingly, shows that direct cash money to families, allowing them to decide how to spend it, actually is the most efficient use of our tax dollars, partly because that money can't be distorted by special interests like Wall Street banks along the way.
How do you reconcile that message that we need, there is an urgent need by the American public? We have images of cars, you know, lined up on highways for miles waiting to get food assistance. They're breaking records in Boston in terms of like the food banks. How do you reconcile that with the idea that because of vaccines coming, none of this is going to be as urgent as it was a month ago? I mean, it's just, it's incoherent messaging. We have like a situation where there was a failure, and now the attempt to sort of rectify or at least to shift blame off that failure is creating another set of problems in terms of messaging in the politics.
Well, she's like a D-list PR person because now Biden's in charge. Oh, the message has to change entirely because the good team is in the White House now.
I don't know. I mean, where do you go with this, Brandon? Because how do you justify more money in 2 weeks or a month if you have the opportunity to do it? And they're doing the same thing. She's doing the same thing too with this continuing resolution where they're trying to push it to October. And you don't know if you're not going to control the Senate. So why would you make a deal now for October as opposed to, let's say, January 25th?
Well, because if you shoot yourself in the foot, you don't have to run the marathon, right? So, you know, if you make it so you have a legitimate excuse, I think that this has been something I've realized the most about the Democratic Party and how they keep their voters in check. They just paint themselves into a corner. They paint themselves into a place where at the end of the day, they can make a pretty legitimate argument that, well, based on the tools we have now, we can't do much to help you. And if you try to argue about what's happening right now, they'll look at you like that's not productive use of our time because now we're here. And so these conversations about what they should be doing now are either ignored only to, you know, 8 months, 10 months, 3 months in the future be treated as though like, well, you know, everyone can play Monday morning quarterback, even though I would argue that these, you know, plays, these strategies are obviously flawed. They're obviously flawed in ways that make it very easy for people like me to come out and say like, it seems like they're trying to lose. Like, you know, it seems like they're trying not to help people and they're trying to do so in a way that is geared towards making it seem like it's everyone else's fault. Either the personal responsibility of the person who's in the food line once they're vaccinated to be unable to find a new job and, you know, pay off everything that they accrued in the time off work, or, you know, it's Republicans, it's just never really able to stick to the Democrats. And I think that we need to start talking about, like, how do we, you know, at least use this time where the Democratic Party is in charge and can be theoretically said to be working on something positive to, you know, hold them to that. Like, if, you know, we do this all the time, we hold their feet to the fire, but doesn't ever seem to stick, doesn't ever seem to work. But I think this time, you know, it's real for people. You know, the feel good wave of emotion that is usually felt by people when Biden or Obama or Democrat du jour take over after, you know, Trump or Bush is going to be soured quite rapidly by the realities of, you know, COVID-19 housing market collapsing, you know, jobs numbers still not being where they need to be, people still being sick. You know, we're running out of hospital rooms in basically every state now.
One of the things, and you mentioned Obama, and I definitely think that Biden's going to have, has already, we're in a different era than we were in 2009. I mean, there's no 2008, there's no doubt. But President Obama has used the post-election period to, I guess, presumably talk about his book, And to cement his legacy in some way, there's a lot of legacy repairing he needs to be, done because, when you go from Obama to Trump, regardless of the different, you know, sort of like factors that, that caused that, some of which are outside of Obama's hands, some of which were inside his hands. I mean, there was a massive foreclosure crisis that, and I don't want to go into the specifics of it. People can go back and look at our interviews about this, about HAMP and all these other programs and Tim Geithner wanting to, he wanted to foam the runway, as it were, for the banks. There was a lot of people who lost their homes. There was a lot of foreclosure. A lot of failure by the Democratic from a policy standpoint and, of course, from a political standpoint, loss of 1,000 seats across the country. So Obama's out there. He has taken one more opportunity to practice respectability politics, as it were. He has said, you know, he's weighed in on the defund the police thing. And it's look. We've talked about the slogan is not, you know, necessarily the one that Madison Avenue would have chosen. The reality is you have half a dozen cities across the country now that are actually following up on the proposals. Minneapolis saw a poll today that city, I think 75% are interested in, are in favor of defunding the police in terms of essentially cutting down on their portfolio and shifting resources away from the police to other agencies. But here's the thing. It's one thing for us to talk about this, but if you are genuinely believing that defund the police was a slogan that hurt Democratic politicians, which I do not think is a legitimate charge, why would you be out there as the most prominent Democrat in the country talking about it 4 weeks before an election in Georgia that is going to determine whether Joe Biden will have any power to do anything? Again, it's about his legacy with total disregard for ostensibly the project that he's supposedly protecting.
I think we're seeing that all around, right? I think we're seeing out of a lot of center left, you know, ostensibly liberal sources, a kind of disdain for the defund the police, abolish the police rhetoric that is born entirely out of their own, I guess, you know, unreflected upon class and social interests, right? You know, it's impossible to have these conversations about theoretically the anxieties that are felt within, you know, liberal spaces about defunding the police because the people who exist within these spaces, at least people like Obama and a few pundits out there, refuse to take personal responsibility for those opinions. You know, Obama can just say, come out and say, you know, I like the police. I remember when that guy harassed a Dr. Louis Gates Jr. And Obama invited them both to the White House for like a beer and a schnitzel thing going on.
Well, Obama's Kaepernick needs to think about the pain he's causing military families by kneeling.
Exactly. Right. You know, it's another way to obscure who's responsible for not liking defund the police. We know. I mean, people who are out there protesting the police, they know that center right wing people do not like the idea of defunding the police. They know that they like the police, right? But within leftist, liberal, center left, Democrat spaces, however you want to call it, the position that, you know, we should change the slogan to appeal to some imaginary outgroup that already that is just not interested in messing with the police in any way, that is not giving them more money or allowing them more power to harass minorities of many different colors, creeds, and religions. You know, we can't have a legitimate conversation about it because ultimately it's about like, well, polling says that people like the police. Polling says that, you know, studies say, and it's like, okay, but let's talk about the role that the police play within the Democratic Party. Let's talk about the role that, you know, these police chiefs play in Democratic cities where theoretically there is no Republican or right wing population to concern ourselves with. Why are police still behaving this way? Because I think, again, you know, how are Democrats obscuring their role in this? They're placing it on populations who might theoretically be in favor of the police, like the suburban moms. But, you know, frankly, from my position, suburban moms don't like the police either. No one likes the police. Police don't like the police.
Or the agency that Democratic politicians have to change the conversation surrounding policing and maybe be proactive, make their own case politically. I mean, Obama wants to punch left, blame activists, blame politicians who might be more sympathetic with the base and activists, as opposed to having any introspection about his own role, Democrats' own role in shaping their own narratives. Republicans do it all the time. They're great at marketing themselves. Democrats will do nothing and then blame the left always, 100% of the time, reactively, for losses when it's really because they chose not to market themselves at all.
Well, I would just say in response to that, I agree. I think the Democratic Party has in many ways given up the sort of project of consensus building. Everything is telling people why we can't have nice things because of blank group of people who won't allow us to have nice things. And, you know, it pushes for, I mean, it instills in people a lot of bad habits. The idea that, you know, we need to have 51% of the population sign off on anything before we, you know, decide that it's a civil right. The idea that, you know, the Democratic Party is incapable of changing people's minds on healthcare through using the bully pulpit. I think that's the kind of narrative that is, you know, both fatalistic, but still kind of egotistical, right? Only a Democratic Party, only Democratic Party's voters are capable of recognizing these things as good or necessary. So we can't do them, but we can still pat ourselves on the back for being on the right side of various issues. I think the defund the police thing becomes a bit more tricky because Democrats have an unreflected upon like of the police too. And so while they're trying to frame it as an outgroup thing or something that, you know, is would be generally unpopular, they're revealing a lot of their own personal anxieties about removing that kind of cudgel from society.
And the very elitism that honestly, now regular voters are associating with the Democratic Party as opposed to the Republican Party based on their attitudes.
Yeah, I'm not. I'm a little bit skeptical about that narrative. I mean, frankly, because I don't know that I've seen that type of like there's really data beyond sort of the commentariat. But what interests me about Obama is, in one hand, I saw a passage from his book where he's talking about that moment in Cambridge where Gates was attempting to get into his house and a local Cambridge cop, approached him and they got into it. And in his book, he talks about Gates being, you know, sometimes a little surly and maybe, you know, I think the implication was that Gates may have gotten like aggressive with the cop. Having grown up and actually spent a decent amount of time in Cambridge, I could tell you my experience with Cambridge cops and with Massachusetts cops and broadly, I suspect that cop was a little bit more brusque than maybe Obama gives him credit for. But what's interesting is in his book, he says like it was like a misunderstanding type of thing. But in a talk with NPR from a couple of weeks ago, He was talking about the police issue, and he says, we don't like talking about the fact that if you grow up in a certain zip code, you're much less likely to be, to get a good education. You're much more, less likely to be a part of networks that allow you to ultimately get a good job. You're much less likely to get good social services in those areas. And that's not the police's fault. That's society's fault. But we'd like to distance ourselves from those responsibilities, lay it on the police to say, just keep it away from us. And when you start seeing that as a consequence of that failure to address deeper inequalities, inevitable tensions, conflicts that pop up, then we're confronted with stuff that we don't like discussing and talking about. And the issue of the particular event between the police officer and a black person who's interacting with them becomes the focal point, but it really raises a broader question, which is, why is it that we're still living in a society with such inequities exist? And my answer would be is because you're talking about this theoretically and you are the president.
Yeah, he knows something about distancing himself from responsibility or is one doing so.
I mean, it's fascinating to me that he almost like pathologically can only see this in the abstract as opposed to like you're in the to the extent that there is an individual who can do something about this. You're the guy, and yet you're making this confrontation about the personalities of the cop and the professor.
Yeah, it's this neoliberal academic lens that, like, the Democratic elite fetishize.
No, I mean, I agree, right? Obama comes out and talks like he's been a professor of law at Harvard for the past 12 years, that this is his first time dipping his toe into like politics in the kind of big P arena that we consider. And it's just not the case, right? He distances himself through abstraction. And like you mentioned, you know, he makes this a conversation about two individuals, you know, the cop who was in a bad mood or might have been in a bad mood and the professor who was in a bad mood who just had a misunderstanding. And you know, it obscures the role that institutional racism plays in these kinds of things. And, you know, it also obscures the role that he plays in, you know, or he could have played in changing this more substantially. And also, I think, you know, it obscures the fact that we have now entered this new phase of the Democratic Party where symbolism is, I mean, the narrative has fully supplanted reality for a lot of people. You know, like Obama asked this sort of mythical president who never did anything wrong, but also whose record we cannot look too deeply into because his hand was always being forced by either Republicans or other special interest groups who wanted him to do things that he didn't really want to do. And so I think when you're looking forward, I mean, when we look towards like what the Democratic Party is demanding now and what their leadership is saying, you know, you see a party who is confused about the language going forward now that the problem has become real for a lot more people, right? Before, you know, Obama, I feel like it's Obama's 18th autobiography, but, you know, before you could splout these platitudes and it was like, well, yeah, that, you know, this is just a story about two people having a bad time. And now it's just like, okay, but now cops are roaming my neighborhood, evicting my neighbors because they don't have jobs. I see it much more, you know, I see it realer now. So like, you know, I think that Obama's role is every few months come out and try to re-up this veil that things are still going fine for the core Democratic voter who is still able to appreciate, you know, working from home because their job was easily transitionable into that kind of like, you know, setting, if that makes any sense.
You know, what is fascinating to me is, and I should say that I'm sympathetic with the idea, and it was years ago now, but I interviewed Randall Kennedy, also a law professor at Harvard, who I think may have known Obama personally, on his book The Persistence of the Color Line, about the Obama presidency up until I think it was 2012, and the idea that Obama had certain parameters because he was the first black president, or maybe not even necessarily the first, but just that he was a black president in this country, that he was inhibited in many respects from reacting in ways to maintain some measure of unity. Now, the problem is it didn't work. Like, I mean, it did not work. And what strikes me as that sort of argument that he had that he was sort of inhibited, which I would believe, right? I mean, there's like a Jackie Robinson quality to this. Why do we see him continuing to do this now? Well, that's the thing. It's like, I think this is who he was.
Well, I mean, I will say, I feel like every president, at least in my lifetime, who gets voted in by Democrats is the first black president. Said about Clinton, Obama, you know, Hillary Clinton was going to be the first black president too. You know, it's just really their thing. You know, you got to applaud them for that. But I think a lot of the times, you know, anyone who works in a corporate setting recognizes the Democratic Party for what they are. It's like, it's middle manager politics. It's middle manager speak. You know, they always want to play that sort of interstitial role or pretend like they do of like commiserating with the working class, commiserating with people who are being kicked out of their homes, who are being denied health and care, who are, you know, in many ways being oppressed by the state that they are representing in some sense. Like, they want to pretend like they are on our side, the same way a middle manager might pretend like they're on the employee side. But, you know, we still have to work late. You know, we still have to work at 9 o'clock. If it were up to us, you know, we would have universal health care. If it were up to Democrats, we would have universal health care. If it were up to middle manager, we would all go home early and get a raise. But the boss, this overarching figure of authority who is sometimes Republican, sometimes a poorly defined block of voters who we have to appeal to, you know, never like oil industry lobbyists. That's never who we talk about as the real concern. It's always just like there's somebody who has more power who's impeding their motion. And I think that's where you see this very, you know, aggressive fecklessness on their part and on the part of their voters, where it's just like, yeah, it's, we are in it together mentality, even as they do their best to screw us over.
Yeah, it's like you're going and trying to get a car, and the salesman's just like, well, I got to check with my manager. I don't have the ability to do that. Brandon Sutton, folks can check out the Discourse podcast. You co-host.
Not blog. I'm illiterate. Sorry.
Here you go at patreon.com. Expand the Discourse. Brandon Sutton, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me. I loved it. You know, I had a bit of an ear infection, but I still heard you both clearly. So
there we go. Win-win.
Win-win.
All right, we're going to take a quick break. We'll be right back in just a moment. On Monday on this program, we will be talking to Ryan Grimm, the chief of the Washington Bureau, I believe it is, of The Intercept.
So maybe the Washington chief,
Washington Bureau chief, or is the Washington correspondent? We're going to be talking about the transition. We're going to be talking about recent appointments. There is, and just the expectations that the, progressives have in, of Biden's picks and, what the implications of these picks are. I mean, you see, it's fascinating to me to be able to compare this to the Obama transition. It wasn't until much after the start of the Obama presidency, it could have been even actually by the end of the first term, that we found out that the guy who ultimately became Barack Obama's chief trade negotiator, a guy named Froman, who was a big Citigroup person, had basically forwarded a list to the Obama campaign at that time, in I think it was September of 2008, of all the people who should be in positions, and it was almost lined up perfectly.
Exactly.
And
all but two, I think.
When we talk about the Obama administration's friendliness to bankers, that's where it comes from. But we will be doing that on Monday. If you missed any part of the show, check it out on Peacock, on the Peacock app. You can find it on the Choice. We play at 5 and 10 p.m. All right. See you on Monday. And for those of you who are sticking around for the rest of the show, we're not even going to go to the fun half yet. We're going to do, it's not going to be full freebie Friday, I don't think. I think we're just extended on Friday. We just do a longer show.
All right.
I don't want to get in an argument about this, Emma. That's just the way we do it.
It's just, you're pissing me off.
Do we have Francesca?
Here she comes.
Okay. Like to welcome to the program Francesca Fiorentini. Should we have her? I hear her. I feel like I hear.
Shall you have me? You have me. Hey, what's going on?
Welcome to the show. I've been meaning to. We mean to have you on the program for forever.
Isn't it funny how you never made it happen until now?
It is. It is funny. It is. I mean, it's not that funny. What's so funny about it?
How'd you get your lighting so nice like that?
Yo, dude, I met someone in like the parking lot of a Petco and was like, you got that ring light for real cheap? And they were like, yep. And it will probably die during this show. So
you got that bootleg ring light?
Yeah, exactly. Got the bootleg ring light. I got like books that I pretend to read in the background. There's probably a guitar that I don't play here somewhere. Oh, my God, Emma, what's going on?
How you doing, girl?
So good to see you. And Sam as well, of course.
Right, of course.
Yeah,
we could take him
or leave him.
I appreciate it.
I just want to say, though, I've been watching the show and listening, and I feel like you guys were really unfair to a grandmother earlier who was wearing a chicken mask, just chicken on her mask. And she's just trying to do what's right for America, y'all. Just give her a break.
I didn't know that.
Sweet, sweet grandmother.
Chicken on it?
I can't believe how incomprehensible that clip was. I honestly,
she said big back better, by the way. She messed up. So
I'm sympathetic to people who can't pronounce things stumble over their words. I do that every day.
Mm-hmm.
But at the end of it, I like to think that the gist of what I'm saying is somewhat cohesive, or at the very least, you know, you got one job to do right now, and that's to get a stimulus. And if you're not going to do it, even if you're doing CYA, that's the best you can come up with? I just don't understand it.
She was about to be like, big back, baby back ribs. Anyway, whatever it is, he's a Democrat and he's in, and I'm in power. Bye.
That's honestly would have been better.
Yeah.
Yeah. Just, you know, throwback to Chili's. Look, Nancy. I agree with everything that's been said already, but I do just want to say it takes a bold woman to wear a mask with a hen on it.
Can we see?
And a bold woman to wear a shirt with a bunch of animals on it.
Yeah, she always has like the fanciest scarf on that's definitely $4,000 from like Hermes, just to emphasize the point that she's rich as hell.
It's very, I don't know. I just think that we need a, I think a lot of this is just generational with the Democratic Party. I think, you know, they've just appointed Sean Maloney, who I'm not necessarily a big fan of, to be head of the DCCC. This is a guy who they trotted out in the AG race. I guess it was, maybe 4 years around when Zephyr Teachout was running, and it was essentially to block Zephyr Teachout's upstate vote tallies. And he came out and ran. He had no real interest, I think, in the job whatsoever. It was literally just to suck some votes from her. But he, at the very least, is out there when they ask him about defund the police. He says, look, that's irrelevant. And he actually just starts to take it to the Democrats. I mean, to the Republicans, rather. At least there's, you know, like I understand that there are Democrats who have a different ideology. But the idea that you don't realize like you're engaging in politics with an opposition party seems to be, I don't know, just bizarre to me.
Yeah, I mean, just a quick point on Maloney. Like, does everyone in Matt or Brendan said this before the show, does everyone in Democratic leadership have to be from New York or California? I mean, it's just crazy because I feel like it's so much about the fundraising aspect, and that's where the biggest donors are. And all of these are moderate centrist participants in leadership. But if you really want to give Republicans, it's like they want to give Republicans the talking point that they're the elitist from the coast. Like, just put someone there that's from the center of the country that might have a different perspective. I mean, Tim Ryan, whatever. Like, I don't know.
And also just rub it in our faces. I'm in California. Or just like, this is the best you can get with your Democrats. And we're like, we know. Damn it, we know. That's what I feel like it is, mostly. So you guys trying to get that preemptive pardon or what?
Yeah, I'd take one.
Yeah, I'd like to.
Who knows what we're going to do?
Preemptive pardons, the best strain out there.
Dude, I'd like to do some light treason in my lifetime and like some shoplifting at Anthropology.
Nice.
Just one or the other.
Well, you'd be able to do both.
Yeah, ideally at the same time, if I could find some way to hawk my own line of, you know, lip balm at Anthropology. I don't know. I just want to follow in the footsteps of Ivanka. Or like what I'm trying to say.
$5 smelly candle.
Yeah, exactly.
Those sweaters are so nice, but they're all $100. I want to shoplift from Anthropology too. You want to do it together?
Please.
I am getting the sense that they're coming out with this whole notion of 20 preemptive pardons as a way of essentially foaming the runway, as it were, for like 10 preemptive pardons, right? Like, it's only 10,
but there's no way the legality of a preemptive pardon stands. I mean, it's fun to discuss. It's fun that Trump is, you know, this ridiculous and wants to shield his kids and, you know, sweaty Giuliani from legal issues going forward. But there's no way they're actually going to stand if Ivanka, say, gets indicted on, you know, some corruption charges.
I honestly think he should pardon as many people as possible, because once again, when Biden assumes the presidency and there is absolutely no accountability for the most crooked president in American history, and we just move on from it and normalize everything, Democrats won't look so bad. I feel like it behooves them to like, yeah, let him pardon so that we don't have to pretend like we're going to try to in the future.
Yeah, I mean, I actually think that I wouldn't be surprised if there was some sense in the Biden administration that would be a good way for us to wash our hands of it. I mean, that's sort of what Brandon was talking about on some level. It's like, I can't do anything because of the manager in the back. Just the nothing I can do about it.
You got these girls shoplifting from Anthropology. I don't know. I don't see anything. I've seen them on the majority report.
Francesca, let's If you want to look at some, have you been following any of this stuff that's going on? I don't know if you're aware of this, but the Republicans are trying to argue, or at least some, that there was massive voter fraud.
I've heard about this. Yeah, I have.
Been going on. And this is a video that dropped about Georgia. And this is apparently now Kemp. So you got Trump going to Georgia tomorrow, and they're terrified that he's going to come in and say, don't vote.
Yeah.
It's all rigged.
Sidney Powell's already saying it.
She's already saying it.
My favorite lady of the 2020 year.
Just an
absolute iconic queen.
Icon. Yes, absolutely.
The $750 I gave them for this effort. I'm feeling pretty good about it. Yeah. I feel like that money's working for me. But they got Kemp has come out and said, we're going to audit the signatures on these ballots of a race that's already been called. You've got Raffenberger going after some of the voter registration thing, and it's ostensibly about this video. Play this video. This is clip number 5. This is a video that the Trump team has offered. This is from OWN, which I know is your favorite network, Francesca.
But I stopped watching.
Get owned.
Just moved to OANN.
There we go.
I think it's just OAN now.
Yeah. At about 8 o'clock in the morning, we're going to roll this back and show it to you. There you go. So now they're going to start pulling these ballots out from under this table.
Pause it for 1 second. These are ballots that were pulled out from underneath the table, right? Because everybody knows you're supposed to keep ballots on top of the table, not store them under the table.
Because what could that mean?
My object permanence does not allow me to understand there are ballots that exist if they're not in view right now.
All the time. That's right. And also because everybody knows that most ballot counting offices have those trap doors like they do. For
right.
What they do. And the ballots come up. But the argument is that these ballots were there when there was no officials observing the count. So listen what happens here.
Table, the black one, was placed there by the lady with the blonde braids at about 8:22 a.m. in the morning. So she put that table there. So the same person who's staying behind now, the same person who cleared the place out under the pretense that we're going to stop counting, is the person who put the table there at 8:22 in the morning. Yeah, I saw 4 suitcases come out from underneath the table. Yeah, upper right hand, you see the gentleman in the red. So he just pulled one out.
Wow. Oh, look at that.
So what are these ballots doing there, separate from all the other ballots? And why are they only counting them whenever the place is cleared out with no witnesses? Is the question. So these machines can process about 3,000 ballots an hour. You have multiple machines there, and they're there for 2 hours. So you do the math. How many ballots went through those machines in those 2 hours when there was no one there to supervise, to be present, consistent with your statutes and rules, to supervise the tabulation? We believe that could easily be, and probably is certainly, beyond the margin of victory in this race.
Yeah, no, wait, where is the other clip, Brendan? The public broadcasting guy.
He's referring to the guy in the video.
Wait, do we have that that clip?
There's a guy in a blue jacket in this clip.
Okay. So this guy, here is a tweet following up that video from Stephen Fowler from Georgia Public Radio. See the guy in the blue jacket in some of the camera screens in this video? That's an official monitor from the Secretary of State's office who was there watching the voting counting.
Oh my God.
Like, this is just bat crap crazy.
I know, but when you listen to them in a vacuum and you already have the preconceived idea that the election was stolen, you're like, well, that does seem suspicious or a little stitious, right? Like, that's what people who are predisposed to conspiracy theories think. They hold on to the little kernel and then they expand upon it. So it's unfortunately effective for a good 15% of the population. I'm cutting the Trump support.
I was going to say 15%.
I was being maybe a tad generous, but like, that's enough in Georgia. Look, I'm still skeptical that this undercutting of the value of the vote and the integrity of the elections is going to translate into a positive result for Democrats in Georgia. Who knows? Because Republicans usually just show up anyway. But there's a chance. There's a significant chance, especially as this misinformation continues to spread.
Yeah. No, I agree. They've been caught in their own, like, grift queue continuum. Like, they've found this point where they're like, voting doesn't matter and it's all a fraud, but also get out the vote. No. And they've collided and now they're just lost in their own conspiracy. And they're trying to crawl and get out of it by getting the man, the most petty, petulant, self-absorbed president person in the country to get out the vote for two senators he couldn't care less about.
Doesn't care.
What do you think is going to happen tomorrow? Like, I honestly, this is the first time that I've been genuinely interested in what this guy's going to say for years. Like, I'm just like wondering, like, he's coming in there and you'd think, like, presumably he's coming, right, to support them, or, but it's also, I can also
he
think like,
but that's what Kemp was doing. That's when Kemp said, we're going to, you know, rescan these signatures and re-audit them. That's just like a little cookie to throw at Trump. So that he doesn't like disregard the Georgia races in his rally tomorrow.
Francesca, what would you say? Where are you going to go with this?
I'm going to go with lots of droplets. That's what we know will happen. It's a rally. There's going to be a lot of COVID. Tons of COVID, all the COVID. So that's one at this time when we're like having, you know, increasing cases, crazy numbers of death. But I don't think he's going to refocus it on Loeffler and Perdue at all, because he's got literally nothing to lose at this point. And except for the presidency itself, he doesn't care about the Republican Party. And Loeffler and Perdue, to be real with you, look, I know Giuliani and Sidney Powell and Jenna Ellis, when they're standing behind the podium, they kind of look like the Adams family, you know, like of MAGA lawyers, attorneys, and it's great. But that's MAGA. Like, MAGA is just miscreant, like, randos strung together. MAGA's not necessarily the Republican Party, especially not Loeffler and Perdue, who are super swampy, right? MAGA's like beyond swamp.
It's called emotional. I mean, that's what I feel like people don't get. It's about this big, like, group hanging all together, feeling fired up, getting COVID, spitting in others' mouths. Like,
but how is that not the Republican Party? I mean, the Republican Party is...
we don't know. We
still
know
sort of like 90% white.
Yeah,
it is. There is. They are at least, you know, I don't know, a third at least identify as however you want to call it, religious fundamentalists or Christian nationalists or however you want to call that. I mean, this is like a pretty cohesive group of people. And if you go to a Tea Party rally 10 years ago and look at the people holding the monkey, you know, that is supposedly Barack Obama, I think there's going to be a pretty, the Venn diagram is going to fit pretty nicely.
Sure. No, I'm just saying that, like, OAN, it's OAN greater than Fox News at this point, right? It's, there was conspiracy, you know, that the ballots, the machines were created in Venezuela by Hugo Chavez 10 years ago, greater than, hey, maybe we lost and we got to like redouble our efforts for the future, you know, Republican Party. Like, that's, they've been grooming their base for this crazy moment. And now, like I'm saying, they're lost in it. So it's, I will be very surprised if Trump makes a hard sell for Perdue and Loeffler. I think he's going to focus on Raffensperger only. He's going to focus on Kemp. He's going to focus on so-called fraud. He's going to talk about the guy in the blue shirt and the woman with the blonde braids. And that's it. And how he's been wronged.
How does he pivot? He talks for a half an hour about how the election's been stolen. He goes, but still important to vote for the lady and that other guy.
Yeah, well, I mean, he did this stuff in Arizona, too, when he had rallies. And infamously, he said, like, no one wants to hear from you. Come on, Martha McSally. Like,
yeah, you got 1 minute. You got one minute. Come up here.
But you, yes, that would have been enough. I mean, I know it, not for her, but in the past, that would have been enough to just drum up enthusiasm in the general state and in the area for that candidate, just because Trump was there with them for 30 seconds, right? That would have been enough for the base. But now there's that schism that we're talking about. Like, does the Trump base go with the Republican voters when Trump is not on the ballot and won't be the president?
Listen, this is an example of, and you know, the funny thing is that, like, there's no ideological difference, and there's really no anything but, except for performative difference between, let's say, Dan Crenshaw and Malkin. But here, play the,
oh God, Malkin. Oh God.
Put up the, Michelle Malkin, put up the, where is this?
Oh, I missed her.
Is it? Oh, it's an image. Okay, here it is. So here is Crenshaw. Pop this Twitter up, this Twitter exchange. So here's Crenshaw talking about the lawyer, Lynn Wood. This lawyer is representing, at one point, like years ago, he represented Richard Jewell, who was accused of being the Olympic bomber. And most recently, he's representing the shooter from Wisconsin who killed three people at protests, Rittenhouse. He has apparently, you know, contributed to different people over the years, including Ronald Reagan, including Barack Obama. But he is the guy up there. He's been, you know, riding shotgun with Sidney Powell. So here's Dan Crenshaw. Lynn Wood is a Democrat that wants Republicans to self-destruct. Just because he wears a MAGA hat does not mean he shares a single value with you. He just wants your donations for his legal fees. He's a grifter. Now, that to me sounds like about as Republican as you can get, right? I mean, that's what Donald Trump has raised, $200 million off this. The whole thing is grifty. But look at Malkin, right? Do we have Malkin's response? Dan Crenshaw is a globalist, John McCain in an eye patch, who loves to party while our country burns. Protect our election system and our country, not the GOP swamp. I love it.
Who loves to party hardy?
Yeah. Is she trying to say that, you know, he likes to shotgun beers or something? I don't really.
Yeah. Is that an eye patch reference? It's like party hardy. It's like, what's the, what are we talking about here?
Is there going to be conservative outrage towards her like there was for Hassan Piker for just daring to point out the fact that he has one eye? I don't know.
What we can all see and he can't. Anyway, I first of all, Lynn Wood, Sidney Powell. I mean, I'm just so glad that we haven't seen these characters earlier and that we're saving them for lame duck final lap Trump, because right, they're the best. Lynn Wood looks like he was hired to be a Trump impersonator at your 40th birthday. Like, straight up, the guy is brilliant. But he's also repping not just Rittenhouse, but the McCloskeys, right? He's representing people who the Republican Party have had at the RNC, who they've lifted up, and suddenly now he can't be trusted? I think he's part of your band here.
That's a good point. It would be really tough to who would you bring out in the final act to be more Sidney Powell than Sidney Powell?
I don't know. I mean, she just stands there like looking like the Yeti. I love her. I love Sidney Powell. There's been few Trump adjacent folk that have given me more joy than that woman.
From a narrative perspective, it is, you could argue that that Rudy should have saved the drippy hairspray for like a week from now.
Yeah.
Right?
Maybe he'll just melt on inauguration day into the floor finally. And that will be the grand finale of the
just come out and have forgotten his pants.
Right.
Like that, and just be like, what? Say something.
Yeah, because the fart after the hair dye, it kind of didn't hit as much.
You guys play that yesterday?
Yeah, we did.
I only saw it this morning. Was that real? He actually did fart?
It seems, it appears that he actually did fart.
And judging by Jenna Ellis's reaction.
She did.
I don't know. I've seen people like drop that in on audio. Like,
yeah.
Back in the day, the old fart tapes.
Yeah, you can reverse engineer that by seeing a reaction, but I haven't seen anybody debunk it yet. So, yeah.
It's deep fake, deep fart. I think we're going to see a lot more of it as, you know, technology moves on. So.
Since we're talking about the cavalcade of people who are on board with this whole election thing, oh, Emma's leaving, but this is going to be you're going to be bummed. You're going to miss this.
Be right back.
Okay, she's going to be right back. Maybe we should wait because it's a Dave Rubin clip. All right, no, she's not going to get this. Francesca, watch this. This is Dave Rubin. I just watched a clip, incidentally, of Dave Rubin that somebody had sent me from like 2015, where he was talking about how he liked Bernie.
There's always a "I love Bernie" clip. Why?
Here he is, though. He is so ready to go, sort of galt.
Oh my God!
We're gonna start today by talking about some of the voter fraud stuff, because there's a lot happening and you're not seeing it on CNN. And again, this reality war that I'm always talking about, if stuff's happening, there are hearings happening in Pennsylvania and in Arizona and in Michigan. There are all these hearings happening. There are people who have signed affidavits saying that they have seen fraud, giving specific evidence. Trump's lawyers made some pretty extreme claims yesterday that were then submitted to the court. So we're going to show you some video on that. But if you don't hear about any of that, and then it starts going through the system, and then it's 2 weeks from now, and suddenly everyone's like, whoa, maybe something really did happen. Well, then you're going to be set up to have a nervous breakdown. And I think half the country is heading in that direction.
Do you understand what he's saying there? That he's saying that, like, you know, it's going to be so shocking to us in 2 weeks when this election's overturned that we're all going to have nervous breakdowns. Is that what he's trying to say?
I don't know. I was focusing on all the things in his background, like the black globe and the little prism that needs some succulents. But yes, something like that. I'm just wondering how they're going to pivot. Like, once Biden actually does assume the presidency, are they ever going to pivot? Or is this always going to go down as the fake fraudulent election?
Like, I mean, do they have to pivot? Like, haven't we learned at this point that, like, they don't have to pivot? They just it's a reset. Like, I'm just going to save that for Monday, and I'm going to come back Monday as if, like, none of this ever happened. And
absolutely.
They did it with every policy. Let's go back. Let's continue to play this, because I don't think people are going to have a nervous breakdown in 2 weeks, because there's been 40 court cases and they've lost every one but one.
I think this video is good evidence that half the country might be close to a nervous breakdown, though.
That's true. And that it's apparently night on his globe. But go ahead.
Then submitted to the court. So we're going to show you some video on that. But if you don't hear about any of that, and then it starts going through the system, and then it's 2 weeks from now, and suddenly everyone's like, whoa, maybe something really did happen. Well, then you're going to be set up to have a nervous breakdown. And I think half the country is heading in that direction, in case half the country's not having a nervous breakdown now. So that's what we're going to be covering today. I am ready to roll. Like, I'm ready for the revolution. I really am. Like, if this is what these motherfuckers are going to do, like, I'm here
whoa,
for it. Like,
whoa,
I am not whoa. Going to be your bitch, Eric Garcetti. You have no right to lock me into my house. And I'm going to live my life as I see fit. But before we get to all that, let's talk about GlintPay, guys. I've been telling you guys about GlintPay. And if you don't know, the world is in a very precarious spot. One of the things that's lasted for a long time, that people have cared about for a long time, well, that's gold. And using your GlintPay card, you can not only buy and sell gold, but you can use your card, which is also a MasterCard, to make purchases. You could buy a pocket constitution with your GlintPay card, okay, guys? You can buy anything that you could buy with a normal MasterCard. You can do it with your GlintPay card.
Oh, my God. I missed the first part, but he went after Garcetti in this, like, oddly
why?
Violent
have
way.
You ever heard him, like, swear like that? It's
right?
Isn't yeah. it?
But GlintPay, you can buy a pocket constitution, because he's trying to be Glenn Beck now and is super bad at it.
Right. I love the argument that gold, you need to have gold. And so here's a credit card.
And it's made of human flesh. I mean, this is where they'll definitely hawk human flesh in the future. I have no doubt.
I just love like everything's going to go, everything, the reason why you get gold is because everything could crash. We're in such a precarious notion. So here's a credit card.
So until that happens, you know, use this MasterCard.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like that Eric Garcetti is trying to make you his bitch?
Gladly. No, of course not. I mean, look, if he gets appointed to the Biden administration, then yes, we are all Garcetti's bitch. But no, this is what's so fun about being in California is just the, like, again, the best Democrats we have. I mean, not the best, but some of, yes, the best Democrats we have are like Newsom and Garcetti because they're not evil, but they're just showboating corporate Dems who truly do not care. Garcetti like consults his crystals every morning, just very Angelino. He's like, the rose quartz is telling me we need to shut down the salons. Like that's the level of Garcetti. And then all the people who like hate him but won't leave, like, you know, Ben Shapiro, get out of here. Go to Nashville, homie. Go. Right. Go.
He went to Texas. He wore a cowboy hat and he posed next to a truck that was way bigger than
they're in Nashville.
Oh, Nashville.
Shapiro. He moved?
Yep. Yep. Oh, they're good. In Nashville.
So why is he talking about Garcetti making him his bitch?
Oh, sorry. No, Ben Shapiro moved to Nashville. Ruben is stuck with a, you know, really expensive house and.
Yeah, right. Picture that. I mean, it must be tough being locked in that place with next to the pool.
Ugh.
Doesn't
I bet it's heated.
He lose all his friends anyways?
Yeah, I mean, he has that big grand dinner party and no one wants to hang out with him. Not even like the Steven Crowders. Not even anybody in the conservative circles want to hang out with Ruben because even to them, he seems like a bullshit artist.
If he's going to talk that tough, why isn't he going out and getting arrested?
I know.
He's like, ready for the revolution with a little unbuttoned silk shirt, you know?
We do have a second clip that kind of...
All right, well, we'll see now. I mean, he's ready for the revolution, folks. What's he going to do for the revolution? I know, movie night. You going to play this clip?
And then,
do we not have that on the sound sheet, Brendan? I can pull it up real quick.
Yeah, no.
Oh, I'm sorry. I have this. I posted this. Give me one second.
Here. Movie night is a contribution to the Rev, by the way. But no, he will not be. He'll be there. He'll be there until the very end. He'll be like, I think I hear them. I hear them coming.
All right, here it is.
And guys, watch V for Vendetta tonight. You know what? Maybe we'll do a RubenReport.com movie night. We've done a couple of these. If you join us at RubenReport.com, we all watch a movie together, and then we do a big live chat. Maybe we'll do a huge video chat as well. Maybe we'll just get a couple hundred people or something in on a big Zoom chat. Because you need to watch V for Vendetta. And it's an incredible movie. And I think we're getting to the point where we're going to have to start doing some crazy shit because these people are horrible and they want us locked in our houses forever. And the reason I mentioned V for Vendetta, it's very much about this sort of overreaching government thing. But one of the things that V says is that people should not fear their government. Government should fear their people. And we're just about there, guys. We're just about there. And if you happen to live in a freer state, God bless you, and you're smarter than I am, and maybe I'm on my way. Florida, how you doing? But you should care about this, too, if we are to remain the United States of America.
But the weather here and the space in California, you know, I mean, it's really hard. But I'll be there. I'll be there on the front lines. You guys just say, you know, get started. Get it started.
Again, I love him talking about God. Remember, he departed from TYT ostensibly because of a disagreement about atheism, because he was an atheist at the time. A liberal atheist, and now he's a conservative lover of God. God bless you. God bless you, my viewers. My pocket constitution.
I love the idea of like he's getting ready for something crazy. I wonder if that's going to be, we're going to do a double feature, V for Vendetta, twice in a row.
Yep.
How crazy we're going to get. I want to see that dude out on the streets, honestly. Like, let's see him out on the streets. I want to see him put his money where his mouth is, essentially. Right? I mean,
yeah. Front lines, buddy. Let's go, Roops. Let's go. I want to see you in a shield that you home painted you know, one of the little weird ones, some goggles. Yeah, exactly. You practice in your home there. See, you got a moat already.
Will you keep that up, please? I mean, it's a nice looking house.
It's painted.
Oh my God, dude, look at that. That's going to be rough. He is so mad.
Can you imagine being able to go swimming during this every day in your backyard?
Oh, my gosh.
He'll be right behind you guys. He'll be right there, though. He's coming. Oh, can you use his house? Nah, see, because, like, the cleaners are coming, and they got to – yeah, there's a little bit of gunk at the bottom of the deep end. But otherwise, you could totally train here for your race war, but, like, not today.
Yeah, we're gonna organize and we're gonna do something just like Viva Med. Can't do it at my place just because, like,
yeah. I mean, they bombed Parliament in Viva Vendetta just to elaborate that.
Since when did Viva Vendetta, which, by the way, hello, 2005? Like, what? When did this film come out? But, like, when did it become a right wing, like, clarion call? Like, what is? The message is, I mean, I'm not going to nerd out over the fact that the message is very left, but, like, why? Why V for Vendetta now? And also, it's, I don't know, it's so corny. It's just so corny. Guy Fawkes masks. Come on, man. Like,
no, they claim all of the authoritarian art that is supposed to be criticizing the right. Like, Ruben is always talking about 1984, you know? It's so lazy.
And while he's saying don't believe the election results in front of your very eyes, right? Like, ignorance is bliss or truth or whatever. I forget what 1984 said.
Yeah, ignorance is truth.
It's pretty stunning how this guy, the big action they're going to take, this complete craziness. We're going to watch V from Vendetta. Maybe even do like 100 people on a Zoom call.
Break, I think, Zoom's terms of service. Look out, guys.
Twitch, that's the whole
purpose.
That's
right. We're going to do this on my own platform.
I mean, maybe we will. Maybe I'll get lazy and just take a swim, but maybe I'll organize a Zoom.
I want to see him move to Florida. He's not moving anywhere. My God. He's already planning. He's already hoping that that Biden makes it all the way through because of that promise.
Because then he can retire. Yeah. Did you hear about this, Francesca?
No.
Said he made a bet that he'd delete all of his social media and he'd never, ever work again as whatever he is if Biden makes it through all 4 years. So it's really just it's a win-win, as I said. It's an out for him from trying to actually have to appear talented at doing what he's doing now that he's no longer a classical liberal, can't use that kind of as a shield. And then then he'll look like a genius, say, if Biden, you know, doesn't complete it. So.
Who are the people that watch him at this point? Like, nobody. I mean, is it like... does he still have the same audience that he used to have on Beck's show? Like,
I'm looking up his subscriber base right now.
I'm just curious as to, like, who's watching him and going, you know, like, are they going to go in like a month? Like, hey, dude, like, what happened to the whole thing? Like, about, like, we were going to go all Viva Vendetta thing. Like, what happened with that? Why aren't we doing that?
He has 1.45 million subscribers.
This is breaking, ladies and gentlemen. The U.S. House of Representatives just passed a bill decriminalizing marijuana, voting yay, 221 Democrats, 5 Republicans, 1 Independent, for a total of 228, voting nay, 6 Democrats, 158 Republicans, for a total of 164. Of course, you know, this is, I think this is probably a Georgia thing. Again, I mean, so much of our politics right now are focused on this, but this is, it's going to be interesting to see what Ossoff and Warnock have to say about this, because this is going to put pressure on sitting senators, right? And
a lot of red states did pass legal marijuana, like medicinal and recreational, maybe.
That was the one. I think every single pro legalization or decriminalization referendum across the country passed, whether it was about pot or whether in some instances it was about decriminalizing a whole host of drugs. This feels like it's 4 years too late in terms of leveraging. I mean, it's not too late, but it seems, I mean, like, why couldn't somebody have had this idea that, hey, maybe this hugely popular thing about decriminalizing and legalizing pot, maybe we should leverage that since we all smoke pot.
Yeah. And I mean, six Democrats voted no. That's insane to me. But you look at the polling on this issue and it's just overwhelming. 70%, 75%. Like, the fact that it's not going to pass the Senate in its current iteration is just an amazing indictment on what's left of a democracy.
I mean, I think it's, Sam, it's because they don't smoke enough weed. Like, I think, look at Pelosi. Come on. You think she tokes up? No. Should she? Yes. Does it breed empathy? Yes. You become more empathetic. Every Democrat, every politician, I don't trust you if you haven't gotten high in the last 6 months.
You don't think Nancy Pelosi was high during that press conference?
I mean, to wear the hen mask, you gotta, you know, be on a next, some next level. But no.
Great, it's not the chicken. I just figured it out. It's because she's a mother hen.
What?
Wait, is
this
real?
Totally is. She's like, if I'm sure she would have rather spoken about her mask as well.
I made that up. I don't know.
All right, let's, as long as we're talking about social media, should we play the Tim Pool thing? Which is your, are you a Tim Pool fan?
Yes.
I'm going to take that as a no. Brian Kilmeade, let's play this. Have you been on Parler yet? Has anybody set up a Parler account?
No,
I set up one. I think I was.
That's on brand.
I think it was like one of those. Like, yeah, like last weekend, I was. I think it was like that was my huge like party for myself. Like I'm gonna drink some bourbon, and then I got drunk, and I was like, I'm gonna do something crazy. I know I'm gonna start a Parler account. Yeah. That's probably what it was. It was like because I couldn't. I was gonna do Viva and Vendetta with like 100 people on. Mm-hmm.
Did you put on your Guy Fawkes mask when you set it up?
Then you realize
that's your avatar.
Poke holes in your leftism.
Here is Brian Kilmeade, latest to suggest. Oh, incidentally, didn't Parler have like some recently, like there was some breach of all their data? Some people, I guess, apparently on Parler, there's some people who are asked to put their social security number in.
Yes, this. Have you not talked about this story? It's the best. It's the best thing.
Story, because I don't know the details of it. I did not enter my social security number for whatever reason. I just thought, like,
maybe not a good idea.
I don't think I'm going to give the guys on Parler my social security
number. But you did put in your Glint card number, right?
Of course. That's the way I paid for it. Wait, so tell the story.
Smart about, man.
Will you? Have you followed this? Tell the story about the Parler, like, social security thing. Do you know anything about?
I know. I just know that a giant hack happened.
Some of the details were that you needed to enter in your social security number if you wanted to be verified. So
first of all, just assume that like there's no politics involved in this, right? That it's not like conservatives who are worried about Big Brother and big tech.
Sure.
Who goes on social media and says like, oh, I'm going to give them my security number as a way of verifying who I am. Like that's
a free speech lover.
Like right now you could float. It's a beautiful little hack and a phishing scheme. If you floated a blue check mark for someone on Instagram or Twitter right now and all they had to do was put in their social, so many people would do that. Like doesn't politics not involve. It's the thirst, Sam. Thirst.
That's insane. And so people put their social security number on there. And then what happened, Matt? Did someone like I can't, I was reading about it. Like I read at first that it was a hack. And then after that, it was just like a breach. I don't know what that means. Like that they may have left the door open or something like that.
Yeah. It looks like it was a bit exaggerated. This is from Snopes here. Oh, maybe this is an older rumor. This is from November 24th, so I'm not really sure. I did see some people downplaying the severity of it, though, that were, I don't know if they were just trying to cover embarrassment or not, but
But here's Brian Kilmeade. He is basically saying that apparently he's not adding enough followers on Twitter or something. Mm-hmm. So, you know, he's been definitely shadow banned. I'm sure that's basically that's almost why you set up your own social media platform. But here it is. Here's Brian Kilmeade threatening to go to Parler.
I have some good news. I'm getting alerts every 10 seconds. I joined Parler. Last night, and it seems like people are realizing that. So if it works out, I will leave the other social media behind.
We'll
see what happens. I think I'm gradually going to get away from it. Because
I've been meaning to. I just haven't gotten around to it.
Right. I'll see if I can get you a password.
I think you can. I think it's free. I think from what I've read.
Okay.
Ducey's like, no idea what's going on.
I think it's free, yeah.
Are we really doing a segment about how we're going to leave all social media behind to go to some other platform?
The executives at Fox would not be happy if they could no longer advertise on the social media that, like, normal people use.
The glimmer in Brian's eyes, though,
he
was just like a dad who just discovered TikTok, you know, like there's this thing. And I think I'm going to be a star. All you have to do is learn a few dances, the WAP challenge, you know, like that. He was so sincere.
Yeah.
He did seem like a kid, like a kid with a new like bicycle from for Christmas or something. It was a real, it was almost the happiest I think I feel like I've seen him in a long time.
I know.
Clarifying question, though. You don't have to be a right winger to join Parler. I thought it was for, like, you know, white supremacists, and I'm going to get attacked for even saying that, right? It's like the cool new thing.
Oh, no. I think it is that. Yeah, but I wanted to go there. I mean, because my understanding is that what's happening on there is that Republican politicians are acting normal on social media that normal people use, mm-hmm. and are acting differently on Parler. And I sort of want to observe that delta between those two things.
Observe the delta.
Exactly.
Like the white crane. Just
exactly. That is the Michelle Bachmann that back when she had that. She at one point did a response to Obama's State of the Union, and there were two cameras. One was the CNN camera, and one was the Tea Party camera that was like closed circuit in all mm-hmm. these Tea Party like venues across the country. And so that's the CNN camera, but she did the whole thing to the Tea Party camera. And so she was just sort of like looking like this as she was giving her speech. And it was just off, and it was one of the most bizarre. I can do it like
that's
this.
Parler is just a little bit looking off.
It's just like this. Like here, hold on, I'll do it. Really, I can. I have the ability now to do it like this.
Ooh.
And I give the entire speech like this, and I'm like Michelle Bachmann, and I'm almost just normal. That's it, right?
Just to update on the Parler hack thing. The hack. Was unsubstantiated. It doesn't appear that was true, but there does appear to be some severe data issues with how they. I'm looking at Lifehacker now. It's not safe still. A number of other people have looked at it and said this is not where you want to, for instance, give out your social security number.
The six Democrats who voted against decriminalization of marijuana. This is perfect, actually. I'm not familiar with Peterson or Pappas, but it is. Dan Lipinski from Chicago, Henry Cuellar from Texas, Connor Lamb from Pennsylvania, and Sherry Bustos, who was in charge of getting Democrats reelected or elected.
In the House. She's really had a wonderful year for herself.
I mean, this should tell you everything you need to know that Lamb and Bustos in particular, right? Lamb was sort of the linchpin of the whole argument about how AOC is screwing us and this and that and all lefties. And they are literally six out of over 200 representatives who vote in a certain way. I mean, it's just like that is the perfect encapsulation of just how out of touch the idea that he was the pivot point for that argument it's like it's I don't even know how to. I mean, there. I don't know.
I mean, that should get you laughed out of the room and basically branded as someone who is unable to adequately represent people and who has zero understanding of the average voter. So, like, I don't really care what you have to say about Ilhan Omar embracing anti-police brutality.
And that's something that you don't hear, obviously, reported in a lot of mainstream outlets, right? Because they'll lift up Conor Lamb when he's punching left. But when he's completely, you know, fish out of water and out of touch, no one's going to be like, remember, Conor Lamb voted against decriminalizing marijuana. Also, never been high.
Multiple positions still. By far too many people. I mean, like, we talk about how, and it's, I don't think it's an ageist argument, but older people are overrepresented in Congress and specifically in the Democratic Party. And we see it in the way that Nancy Pelosi governs and legislates with implicit fear of going left and fear of Republicans. And that's how she operates constantly. And so there's so much of that in, and that's treated as the default by the media and entirely.
But Emma, she fought for it in her younger days. She's been marching for Medicare for All since you were dust in the universe, Emma. She's been there, done that. Like, yeah. It's her favorite line to be like, oh, I've tried to do this. You got to resign yourself to apocalypse.
Exactly.
She's a lefty from way back, as David Feldman would say. I mean, the amazing thing about Conor Lamb is like, Conor Lamb is that literally he can't move any part of his body without it basically being a swipe at the left. I mean, that's how far right he is.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, that's the thing is that like, he's so out of touch. The idea that the Democratic Party would come to him. How much do you leave on the table to cater to 3% of your elected officials? Literally 3% of your elected, less than 3%. I can't do the math. It's 2.6% of your elected officials voted against this. And you're going to divert your messaging to save those people. What are you leaving on the table with the rest of the party? That's what's just sort of, just sort of stunning. That's pretty clarifying. You're talking about decriminalization of pot at this point too. It's like,
I know.
Wow. You're catching up with, I don't know, you know, Nevada, right? I mean, Nevada is like fully legal there. Like who?
Yeah.
He doesn't think that people in Pennsylvania want to smoke pot. It's nuts. All right, let's do this Tim Pool thing. And then, well, I guess we're going to do a freebie Friday and then we'll take some phone calls maybe. And I'll turn these on and we'll do some IMs. Who is it? Was this? Which one is it we have? We have one where Destiny's on?
Yeah, there's a Destiny one, and then there's one where Tim announces his little pivot.
Let's do the one with Destiny first. So here is, I guess Destiny went on Tim Pool's show. Did he go in studio? Good for him. He has no family.
No fear of COVID.
No fear of COVID. So Destiny was on Tim Pool's show, and I saw a bunch of clips, and you know, Tim was having a little bit of a tough time, I think, with Destiny a little bit. This guy's real name is Stephen Bunnell, and he is he's a Twitch streamer. I've been on a show with him, but I don't know if it was his show or it was like he had another podcast or something. But here he is. Tim Pool is trying to argue that what Trump is doing is completely normal. Completely normal.
There was a whole lot of the Hillary can still win stuff. And
Hillary conceded the next day.
But
absolutely not even remotely similar.
It's remotely similar. I would say it's
maybe
not,
like
it's not
the way that Antarctica is remotely close to like Pluto.
Do you see the videos of celebrities saying the Electoral College must vote for Hillary Clinton?
Do you think there's a difference?
Well, I'm sorry, they didn't say that.
Do you think there's a difference between celebrities saying something and the President of the United States trying to undermine the election? That's why I'm saying these aren't remotely similar. Yes, undermine.
See, that's framing.
Well, it's when you say so. Legally 2016, challenged. Trump said millions of illegals voted. He asserted that with no evidence. That's undermining the integrity of our election. And then in 2020, he's saying that there was widespread election fraud that literally no agency, no other credible person has backed up save for the melting head of Giuliani. Like, no one else is backing up on this. His own DHS turned on him on this with his own appointee. His own attorney general, the sword and shield.
What did he say?
Barr came out and said that as of right now, there is no evidence of widespread election fraud.
Wait, there's more to that quote.
Wait.
The more to that quote was enough to overturn the results of any election.
Right. And there was actually no evidence of any election fraud. They just keep saying no evidence of widespread election fraud just to cover themselves in the event that somebody finds election fraud. But no, there's been no evidence now 5 weeks out of election fraud. But I love how the fact that like Poole is like, you're using an adjective to describe what Trump is doing. That's not right.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it's just nitpicking just one thing. Because, look, Destiny, I guess that's his name right there. I didn't know. I was unfamiliar with who that is because I'm old at heart. But did a really good job there. But it shows how refreshing it is when you actually get a right-winger to have a dialogue one-on-one with these fact patterns, because it's so overwhelming that all Poole can do is just pick a tiny crumb off of this cake of an argument and say, see here? No. Like, you're ignoring everything else, and it's so glaring.
He was like, Pluto? I'm not sure if that's still a planet. And, yeah, Antarctica? Like, yeah, he's it's fun. I love watching these guys go one-on-one. Let's just be honest, though. This week has been that week where the page, I think, has turned. And it's all just, I think it's just fun from here on out. Because DHS coming out against election fraud was huge. That's how the week began. And now we just get to keep watching these crazies eat themselves alive. And I'm here for it. I'm here for every last MAGA-teer, and I'm excited.
You know what? I have to say, you have a situation where this is a genuine twofer, because the stakes of this are actually really huge, right? I mean, this is all about Georgia at this point. And there's sort of like three incentive structures here, right? You have the incentive structure of the Republican politician to create enough aggrievement amongst their voters in Georgia to come out. Then you have the incentive structure of Donald Trump to push that aggrievement beyond them coming out for an election, bypassing the election and just coming out to support whatever, you know, sort of like fundraising endeavor he has or post-presidency project. And then you have like people like Tim or Ruben who have this incentive structure that is sort of like probably more aligned with Trump, because that's where their cash is,
right,
than actually winning in Georgia. But yeah, they still have to pay lip service to it in a way that Trump doesn't. And that's why you're getting like Michelle Malkin saying that Dan Crenshaw is a globalist. And
earlier I looked at Dave Rubin's YouTube numbers, and his views are very healthy lately.
Oh, there has to be people watching him. I just don't know who it is.
Right.
And so you get to watch them eat themselves, but it's also for a really important cause, which is the opportunity to get like, you know, maybe a major reconciliation bill where there's some massive government spending at the beginning of the year.
Right. So the stakes are incredibly high, even as it is like the thing that makes me nervous is, as entertained as we are by the flailing and the failed attempts to thread the needle of, you know, still being supportive of Trump's conspiracy theories while also trying to galvanize support in Georgia, is that I don't want to actually make the mistake that I think a lot of leftists have made in the past, where we think Republicans are going to eat themselves alive and they're going to
fail,
and then they end up showing up anyway.
Yeah, I think still, the likelihood is that Democrats don't win both of those elections. Maybe they win one. I'm not sure.
Warnock win.
Maybe. But
right.
But
the attack ads are insane, right? That are running constantly against Warnock and Ossoff. But look at the ground game, I think, in November. And I think it'll be really tough, but that is incredibly mobilizing to see that Georgia went blue. That means a lot for the grassroots and traditionally marginalized communities, black and brown communities. So, yeah, it'll be a fight, but it's not being won by Pelosi. You know, Pelosi is, as you guys were talking about earlier, is not the rhetoric is not being seized by Democratic leadership to say we have a chance to really deliver for the American people to help them out in this crisis. Because again, a vaccine, come on. You think essential workers, I'm just thinking about the idea that essential workers are actually going to get the vaccine first. No, it's going to be Taylor Swift and people who like want to go to Taylor Swift concerts. I don't know why I'm picking on her, but you know what I'm saying? It's going to flow the exact same way. And I'm sorry to say this. It's going to flow similarly to the ways that testing has flowed, which is if you can pay for it, you get a quick rapid test. And if you can't.
Without a doubt.
Yeah. I wish it were different, but yeah.
There's 17,000 doses that are coming into New York City, I think, by mid-December. Those are going to go to hospital workers. And after that, it's just going to be like, how much can you pay your doctor?
Right.
And that's how you're going to have the availability. That's without a doubt, I think. And that's who's going to get it in the first, 3 months or so.
I mean, that's just the American healthcare system in a nutshell.
It is going to be fascinating though to see what happens with this race. And you're right. There's only so much. They don't want to nationalize the election, right? But if Pelosi's message, just the idea that Pelosi's messaging is different from Porter's is enough to sort of like muddy the waters. Like where is if the vaccine is coming, then it doesn't matter who controls the Senate. If Joe Biden's president, then it doesn't matter who controls the Senate. I mean, that's what we're hearing. She's saying there's no the urgency has lessened. And that's exactly the opposite of what you need.
Right.
Are people going to come out? If she came out and said it is desperately urgent that Mitch McConnell not control the Senate because we're not going to get the support for Americans we need. Are people in Georgia going to come out and go like, wait a second. I don't want there to be a situation where we actually get the assistance that we need. Yeah. We need to vote for the guy who's stopping it. It's just, I can't believe it. All right. One more Tim Pool, video here. Tim Pool. I have a theory about Tim Pool, and that is that,
the beanie is holding his head together.
No, I was just going to. We think that's a good theory.
I mean, that's conceivable. That's conceivable. But I think that Tim is a little childlike. Now, I have, broadly speaking, I have no problem with that. Like the man boy thing. But I think Tim is a little bit like boy boy.
Right.
And that's been my theory about
Tim. Not boyish, but completely.
I think that he
arrested.
I think, yeah, a little bit, a little bit.
Keep going with it. What do you mean by this? Is it,
I think that I have, I've known Tim since the Occupy days, and, I've watched a decent amount of his stuff, and politics to him seem reminiscent to me of high school, and not even late high school, early high school,
getting braces.
Right. Yeah. Like more like freshman or eighth grade, ninth grade, 10th grade, maybe. But by the time you're a junior, you're like, okay, I just, I get the friends group and we're going to hang out and maybe I'll see you at the parking lot. We'll have a couple.
He's just trying out different personalities.
I think it's more just he sees everything as super clicky and it's not politics in terms of where you have policies that affect millions of people. It's just more it's not even partisanship. It is literally just sort of clicky. Teams. And also that he's making a ton of cash. So imagine if you gave I think you probably have Instagrammers who are like 14 years old and they're making a ton of cash and they're, you know, they figure out, they hire a lawyer and they get emancipated and they buy themselves a mansion and they just, it's all going to be video game consoles. Mm-hmm. And like I built a skateboard half pipe in the den, man. And I think that's sort of like what Tim Pool is. And here he is now faced with like the fact that Donald Trump did not win, despite the fact that he promised his people that they would. And so I think he's retreating to a safe place.
Have that offensive comedy be something. It's like, listen, they want to cancel you. They want to fire you. They want to destroy your jobs. We're chilling. We got a million plus subs. We got a big old vlog channel. We got sponsors. We got drinks. We got all that fun stuff. You can come hang out, skate, and laugh, and you're not going to get canceled. That's what we need to put together. We need to tell the younger generation, you can have fun. You don't got to be a dainty little snowflake. You don't got to be constantly offended to fit in. You can actually be offensive and fit in because we make fun of each other all the time, and it's funny. I don't know if you were watching the IRL podcast last night. We had Heshy Tischler, and he was constantly making fun of Ian, and it was funny. And then he turned around and said, no, you know, I love you. And so that's kind of the thing. We want to be able to, you know, play the circle game without being accused of being Nazis or whatever. We want to just have a good time. We want to get, you know, off-road vehicles and do backflips and just be like, we know what's up in this world. We know what freedom means. We know what ignoring this means.
Oh, my God. Okay, I'm sorry. I don't mean to jump in, Sam and Emma. I just want to say, being able to play the circle game without being called a Nazi perfectly distills the alt-right or just the right nowadays. There are so many origin stories. Like, all he wants to do is to be able to, like, you know, just, like, hang out with my friends, whatever, like, drop the N-word or whatever, and, like, no one's gonna, like, tweet about it. Or, you know, like, that is... The origin stories of some of these Nazi grifters, and I don't know Tim Pool, but I know like someone like Baked Alaska, swear to God, straight up, is someone called them out on something they said that might be offensive, right? Ben Shapiro, no, Jordan Peterson has this exact same origin story. That's how he became what he is. Mm-hmm. Someone said to Baked Alaska when he was working at BuzzFeed, hey, don't say spirit animal because it might be offensive to Native Americans. And he was like, nine, and then just became a Nazi. Like, he... swear to God, this is what happened. Someone
Speaking of Baked Alaska and the circle game, here is Tim Pool and a whole bunch of alt-righters showing the totally doesn't mean white power hand gesture. So that's him with a bunch of alt-righters. So I would say if you want to play the circle game, don't play it among a bunch of alt-righters, and people might not draw that inference.
But wait a second. Anyway. Isn't this circle game where if you like hold your fingers in a circle and the person who doesn't do it gets punched in the nuts?
Mine was in North Dakota. It was, if you hold your hand in that gesture under your belt line and another guy looks at it, you get to punch that guy in the nuts. This is a very homophobic game. I don't know if that is true or across the country,
but I don't understand
doesn't make sense.
If they're playing the circle game, like, I don't understand, why are they posing for a picture? Aren't they supposed to be punching each other in the nuts or something?
Not the circle game in California is where you just you have a circle of witches and then we take a virgin and we sacrifice it to the gods.
Right. Oh, that's like Passover.
Yeah.
But
satanic.
But wait
California.
A second, Matt. When did you play the circle game?
Like junior high school.
Okay. Boom. I rest my case. Tim Pool. Like, how old is Tim Pool? Isn't he like in his 30s?
Well, like, I looked up skateboarding for Tim Pool, and I was reading these tweets of his, and I mean, it kind of just, like, crystallizes what you're saying. I have a rule every time I skateboard. I must learn something new, and I must repeat three times in a row. Often, I will learn multiple tricks in one day, but I must learn at least one and get it on lock. It's like, it sounds like me talking about my guitar lessons at age 13, and I thought it was super deep.
He's 34 years old, and he's talking about setting up a place where you can do the circle game and he's bragging about it. Like, this is the type of thing that you like, you sort of admit to somebody after you know them for a long time. You're like,
sometimes
I'm really mature and I punch my buddy in the nuts. Yeah. And that's what I do. And
you know what it reminds, it's like the Lost Boys for like Never Never Land. And for them, Never Never Land is a place where you can never, never get canceled. And so here we are. We're just a bunch of Lost Boys. You could do whatever you want. And maybe we are actually white supremacists, but no one will cancel us for it.
Oh, you got canceled? Check out our 1,000,000+ subs. I'm sure that will help you feed your family.
Exactly. The YouTube algorithm's so unfair.
What is he talking about? We got drinks too. Has he got his own line of like mangrias or something?
I'm sure it's some Alex Jones thing where you look into the FDA or like the ingredients of it and it's just absolute garbage.
It's called pool water.
Oh my gosh. If he doesn't do that now, if he doesn't start it, the idea
we're giving you free advice.
Pool water is way too good, Matt. That's
a win for him. That's a huge win. Let's go to, let me call in and we'll take
water. It's just drink pool water. I'm sorry. It's from Dave Rubin's pool, actually. Bottled at the source.
Let's do Smyam's. Gupek says Biden should pardon Obama and Hillary for no reason on day one. Maybe Kamala too. That actually is pretty funny.
Yeah.
Militant apathy. She just posted it. Oh, you all need to pull the Michelle Bachmann prayer post on Twitter, says Militant Apathy. I haven't seen that one, but old time's sake, I guess. What the heck happened to Li Fang? He's morphed into a cop-loving ANCAP libertarian. The Trudeau government is going to raise budget deficits to WW2 levels for stimulus relief spending for 2021, yet it will not be massive enough to avoid a massive recession, says depressed Canadian. H-Dub, my sister is an ICU nurse. She's got PTSD from the last spike. She has coworkers who say they won't take the vaccine, don't wear masks outside of work, and sometimes not at work, and are planning group wine tasting trip. She might have to go on leave for mental health and lack of support from her peers. I don't understand how hospital workers can have that attitude. It's nuts. Ginger Red Scare. Hey, Sam, I work at the biggest hospital in Maine where numbers have been relatively low until recently when the state is setting new high numbers every day. My Med-Surge hospital unit was converted to a COVID unit last spring until numbers went down. COVID beds on other units are maxing out numbers, so word is we'll be back to converting to being COVID within the next few weeks. I'm infuriated with how mask wearing and physical distancing has become politicized. I became a widow this year, and I'm afraid for my kids should I get sick. I'm sorry to hear that. Horrible. Sean from NorCal, whenever an anti-masker whines about being a sheep to the government mask mandate, I like to remind them that they're being very hypocritical being the government clothing mandate sheep, wearing clothing like government mandates. It's funny how people are so selective with their fake outrage. I'm super pissed that I'm not able to go in barefoot and shirtless to work.
The
supermarket or to work for that matter.
It's, well, you wear a seatbelt, so it's basically the same thing as a mask. Same thing with like the mandate for Obamacare and car insurance. There's no connection with people in their minds.
Should remind people too that speaking of Obamacare, that the open enrollment is taking place right now. You've got about 15 days, I think it is. So you may want to get on that. Let's see here. All right, let's go to the phones. That's weird. I'm not seeing anybody, but I know. There we go. Shoot. Bear with us, folks. There we go. Calling from a 917 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Alex from New York.
Alex from New York. What's on your mind?
Hey, well, I called in with one thing, but listening to you guys talk, V for Vendetta was written by Alan Moore. If you know anything about Alan Moore, he was mad the movie was made in the first place. Secondly, I want to talk about the antitrust thing that you were talking about yesterday or Wednesday, I think.
Yeah.
Warner Brothers just killed movie theaters yesterday.
Yeah.
So I don't know what more to tell you. All I know, I've been watching this guy, Dan Morrow. He worked on Screen Junkies. He's been covering this stuff for over 2 years now about the way the movie studios have slowly been trying to get around that law that was passed decades ago that prohibited them from buying movie theaters and owning them.
Sin Fin.
They've been
yes.
getting around for 2 years. Yeah. And he's doing great reporting on
so
it.
So what's happening is Warner Brothers is sending their entire output of movies in 2021 directly to HBO. That is obviously going to severely impact movie theaters. And they have a bunch of properties, DC Comics, a bunch of stuff like that.
Yeah, but, I mean, well, it's like Wonder Woman, Matrix 4.
Yeah. We'll see. I it'll be interesting to see if that gets any congressional attention. But I appreciate the call, Alex.
Yeah.
Maybe we should have somebody on about that. Calling from an 847 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, it's Josh from Chicago.
Josh from Chicago. How are you, Josh?
I'm good. How are you, Sam?
Oh, you know, fine.
Good. I have two things. At first, actually, because the guy mentioned about the movie theater thing, I think it's like, I don't know, I think it's complicated, but like, unless you're doing like the private watch party thing, which some cinemas do offer, and I've actually done it, and it's pretty safe. I mean, people don't feel comfortable going to a movie cinema.
Right.
And I think it's with Tenet not performing as well due to the pandemic, I think it's pretty hard to justify doing only theatrical releases, at least next year.
Well, that's the thing. Is that the real question is you know, is this a temporary measure, or is this just simply using this as an excuse to basically cut out those movie theaters? We'll see.
Yeah, I think it's temporary, but I do think like the windows are going to be shifted to where it's like it's only going to be 30 days until like a movie becomes available on demand. And I just think that's sort of where we were headed. But I mean, I don't know. I share theatrical experience, and I hope it doesn't go away. But I wanted to call in specifically because I don't think, Sam, you're upset enough about this near attendance thing. And I'm kind of disappointed. I thought you'd be more upset.
I guess we were, you know, we were talking about this, like we lost, right?
Yeah, no,
and Joe Biden won. And I think Neera Tanden is, if you strip away her, I think she's a cipher, and I don't think that she has any real political grounding. I think that the Biden administration, like this interpretation, I've seen people say like they got near attendance so that Bernie Sanders has to be on the banking committee and like kowtow to her. Like why do people think it's going to work that way? Like why do people think that Bernie Sanders has to kowtow to her when she comes up in front of the banking committee? That's not the way it's going to work. No, I mean, I think like, you know,
I don't think it's deliberate. I think it's going to happen. I mean,
well, I don't think he's going to kowtow to her. I don't
think I think there's going to be, I mean, there will be interaction between the two of them.
Sure.
And I mean, it almost.
Who's that going to be more uncomfortable for? It's going to be more uncomfortable for her. He's a senator. He's sitting in there and she's coming to.
She doesn't see him as like a senator in the esteem.
Well,
way.
I'm
like
sorry.
Chris Murphy.
She's going to have to. Because senators can make it difficult for people in the cabinet, but I mean, I don't think that I think what happens in the Biden transition is they have a list and they say like we have these three or four of these whatever five boxes that we get to check off. One of them is we owe Clinton World, and what do we owe Clinton World? We owe them three
nothing.
Well, the Biden people say we owe them a lot,
yeah.
Right. And they're like,
damn it.
We got, and so how do we fill that? How do we fill one of those things that we owe them? You know, it's not a muffin basket. It's putting somebody into, you know, it's paying off one of their debts. And how do we get, but we want somebody there that we can control that's not going to necessarily have their own agenda. So who's a cipher that we can put in? And I'm not convinced that the Biden people aren't like, Center American Progress, she's a progressive.
Right. Well, like, that's how out of touch they are with the grassroots.
I think that's the problem, right? And like, I think you're actually right, Sam, when you say she's not going to get through. Like, I think they actually kind of are using this as like a way to get through. What's the guy's last
name? Bruce Reed. That's what scares me more.
Deficit hawk.
Yeah, her Twitter activity is like not going to get her. Like she's, I don't think she'll get through. But let's say she does, right? I think the problem is it's the same problem you have with Pelosi, right? There's this sheen of like progressiveness on Neera Tanden, right? I was at, my cousin actually does some videos for Center for American Progress in terms of like some of their informational videos. And I was at a Passover Seder like a few years ago, and they were like, oh, have you like heard of like Center for American Progress? They do a lot of really progressive things. And I was just like, no, they don't. And like, I think the problem is these resistance libs to like people who don't pay attention to as enough as we do. They see Neera Tanden and they think she's a progressive in the same way they see Pelosi as a progressive. And I think, again,
well, but the only here's the only pushback I would give you.
But like,
unless
there's a real danger of her being looked at as a progressive
by whom?
Center right.
But I think that. But Josh, in terms of like the voters, dude, there go ask people who don't have a kid working at the Center for American Progress as to who Neera Tanden is, and they're gonna look at you like what? Like, I'm not saying don't ask around the DSA, you know, meeting. I'm saying like the lib you're talking about, the people who are like, you know, like now we can go to brunch. They don't know who Neera Tanden is. They don't know what the Center for American Progress is. They just don't know. And they don't. And so like, this is the question is like, you know, I think to the extent that there's any calculation on the part of the Biden administration, it is, We gotta throw a bone to the Clinton people. We also gotta throw a bone so that the Republicans have some red meat that they can chew up. And this is a threefer because the left, if they even contemplated that the left would have a problem with Neera Tanden, which I'm not sure that they did, if they contemplated that, because they've said for a long time, like, we don't go on Twitter. And I don't know if that's true or not, but if it's true, like, they may not even know. But if they did know, they'd be like, okay, they'll be able to sink this this pick. The Republicans will be able to sink this pick. And then we can put in somebody who's going to like help us pivot to austerity at one point. Like, that's, to the extent that I have a concern, that's my real concern. Like, Neera Tanden is just going to do whatever the Biden administration tells her to do.
Right.
She doesn't have her own North Star. Let's put it that way. She's a hack. She's a party hack. I think she's also like, I think, there's a little bit of like, you know, not terribly effective at a lot of the stuff that she does.
Not, I mean, that confident.
Like, yeah, exactly. Like,
I mean, she was pushing for Medicare and Medicaid and Social Security cuts back when Obama was doing so.
She was doing it on behalf of Obama.
Right. I mean, so I think it's a gamble that that's not her ideology, but I think you're probably correct. I don't think it's a risky gamble. I think she's more of a...
She's like...
She doesn't have ideology.
Exactly.
Right. I understand that. But, I mean, there... Like, then she is as equally beholden to whoever else is put in her orbit in the Biden camp, and of that's course. A risk in itself. I understand she's better than Reed, but she's not a good pick. And it's going to be BlackRock 2.0 in the Biden administration. And they are also going to have their influence on someone like Tanden if she even gets through. But of course, Reed is a worse option.
I mean, I guess my point is like, there is no good pick that's got that job in a Biden administration. Yeah. Like, we lost that fight months ago. The question is, like, I mean, so I'm not, you know, happy about Neera Tanden in the same way that, like, my, the happiness I have about Joe Biden is that It's not Donald Trump. And, you know, really just about anybody would have taken the COVID serious. It's not like you didn't need Joe Biden to come in, like, you know, anyone from Amy Klobuchar to, you know, I don't know.
Marianne Williamson.
Yeah, would have taken COVID seriously. I don't know about Marianne Williams, I assume, but.
She would have. I like her. Doctor,
so maybe not.
Depends on what the crystals again are saying on that day.
Exactly.
But I do think, Sam, like making a big deal, I think Nir Tandon's a terrible pick as well, but like it is not a rallying cry for the progressive movement within the Democratic Party to make Nir Tandon the sticking point. That's not the hill to die on. Yeah. We're talking, we need, you know, actual relief. We need programs. We need, you know, a free vaccine. We need way more than, and this can't be it. So.
Because that's the politics of people who are more interested in personalities, which is way too much of the left, someone like Jimmy Dore, right? Like, that is the politics of somebody like that, as opposed to people who are seriously trying to make a win.
Well, even if you're interested in personalities, like, Nir Tandon in this administration, while they're failing to do anything on COVID, is just more content for your argument. So take that.
I think Francesca is right about this. The point is, like, what's the hill to die on? And the hill to die on is someone like, you know, Deese is much worse we just mentioned from BlackRock. He's much worse. Now that's already happened. And you look at like the Sunset movement, their piece, they're saying we're not going to litigate Deese. Now they can't because it's already happened, but you use these things to get angry enough and we should make a stink. I just think like making a stink about Nir Tandon gets reduced to, well, they just don't like her because of her, you know, like, cause she's, the way that how online she is. Getting upset about Deese, in my mind, has a lot more value because then it starts to say like, oh, we're getting pushback on how Wall Street friendly we become. And so therefore we need to maybe, I don't know, stop Gina Raimondo or therefore.
Which I think we did. She's not.
She's taken herself out. I mean, who knows how that went down, but that's good. That's a good thing. I just think that like Nir Tandon is just sort of like the shiny like object that is like she, you know, that's about as good as you're going to get at the OMB as far as I'm concerned. I want a labor secretary who's going to get out, who can actually get out in front of this administration. I want Health and Human Services who is not going to be hostile to the concept of Medicare for All, who's going to be like more, you know, sort of these are the positions where you can actually find somebody who could be a technocrat, but also like can push things in certain directions. And so I think the outrage is fine. I just think that like she's not the best candidate for it because it's all like this stuff. Like it's a slap in the face to the left. Who cares? I'm more interested in like the policy implications of this stuff. I don't like, you know, like I'm not in high school. I don't care if, you know, somebody said, Sam's got a fat ass, you know, or whatever it is. It's just like, I want to know, like,
you
know,
thank you.
What?
Yeah, you're sick.
Right. Thank you. I want to know, like, you know, who's in charge of like what we're getting at lunch or, you know, what are my grades going to be? That's what's, you know, that's why I think you're getting caught up on Nina,
Nina Turner,
whatever. Nina Turner would be great.
Yeah, that would be awesome. But
appreciate the call.
Yep. Sure.
I also called the Sunrise Movement, the Sunset Movement today. Yeah, it's Friday, dude.
That's Joe Biden's movement.
I think when I covered that when the Sunrise Movement you know, went to Pelosi's office for the first time, and I think to Varshini Prakash, the head of Sunrise at the time, I called it the Sunset Movement. She goes, "It's Sunrise." I'm like, yeah. "We're editing this out of the video."
Well, we do it live here. All of my faux pas are all hanging out. Trey from Maryland, but in Pittsburgh. Hearing Sam call someone a lib gave me a much needed chuckle. Could I request a shofar for my 2-month-old nephew Garrett, who just passed away? Oh gosh, love you guys. Left his best. I'm sorry to hear that, Trey. Yeah, you can. Sorry about that. Uh, AJ, I'm a dietary worker at a hospital in Metro Detroit. Over the past month, our COVID numbers jumped from 2 or 3 to over 37 last week I was at work. We're so short staffed that management is forcing workers from other departments to work as nursing assistants. And those who don't volunteer basically are set to be fired. The only way you don't have to work on a nursing floor is if a doctor signs off on it. And nearly everyone I know work with, minus myself, has health insurance through the hospital. Luckily, we get paid an extra $2 or $3 an hour if we work on a regular floor or COVID floor. It's very messed up. It's so messed.
But sorry, this is perfect. Like, if there was a national healthcare system that could actually mobilize Americans the way we mobilize troops for war, then hey, there could be volunteers, people who don't have coexisting, any whatever. They're not at risk for COVID. You know what I'm saying? Like, this is what it's, you could begin to see that, hey, maybe government, a little important sometimes. Maybe we would be able to face this if everything weren't just a private system.
Well, one of the things I remember at the beginning of this, when there were all the reports of what was happening in Italy, at that time, one of the problems was like, we don't have the social cohesion of an Italy to get it together, to close down or to wear masks. The other thing is that we don't have the infrastructure in the way that you're talking about, both in healthcare. We also don't have it in the context of like the way that we get money in people's pockets.
Yeah.
I think at one point we played a video of some guy had posted him calling in to get his unemployment insurance in Canada. And it was literally easier than setting a cable appointment by far.
Yeah.
Like, you just call in, beep, 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 and that's it, and boom.
Well, social cohesion, too. Like, in Japan, I heard today, or this morning, maybe it was yesterday, that yesterday the COVID death total, I don't know, I remember, was more than the entire pandemic for Japan. Because they just instituted a mask mandate really early on, and they didn't even do full shutdowns of the economy. They just did a universal mask mandate, everyone did it, and 2,200 deaths in Japan total.
Did they even have to mandate it? My understanding was they just wear masks generally, but maybe they later mandated it too.
Actually, I'm not sure.
I think look, there's a lot more experience with epidemics over there, right. SARS and MERS.
Yes.
Over the years, and so the idea of, in a lot of those countries in the Southeast Asia and in the Pacific, they wear masks more often. But the amazing thing is that after this, we're still not going to have a population that is like the next one that comes through. It's amazing that we're going to go through this and learn nothing.
Mm-hmm.
I think our next time the government will be prepared on some level. I don't think you'll ever get an administration that's going to come in and go like, first thing we're going to do, the dude who sits on the National Security Committee who's dealing with this pandemic stuff. Yeah. Bye-bye.
In the words of the Mandalorian, this is the way.
Where do we have our mechanism to pick up on a possible pandemic around the globe? Yeah. Pull them out. That's a waste. We don't need that stuff. Like, I don't think
Engelins, get them in here. We're eating them. Let's do this. I want to taste a bat.
Exactly.
I love these meathead, imaginary meatheads.
But you don't get the sense that like the American public, like COVID 2026, the American public's not going to be like, let's get our mask. It's going to be the exact same thing.
But this is the thing about, and with Japan and South Korea, which has been a standout, right? It is contact tracing, testing, and isolation. And all of those things subsidized by the government have prevented the need to even have a mask mandate. Right. Those three pillars of tackling a pandemic that, once again, Sam, you're right, that they have pioneered because of how they face SARS and MERS and others. And we're still not going to have that. So masks, we have to understand, masks are like tiddlywinks. Masks are nothing. Masks are ridiculous and superfluous, critical because we've got nothing else, but they're not even on the like first five things you have to do in a pandemic.
Right. I mean, because Because the government does the things that you're talking about, right? The contact tracing and the
testing and quarantining.
And the quarantining, which involves like allowing people the resources to quarantine. And all of those are like government like actions and policies, whereas like a mask mandate is like, we implore you to do something as an individual. All right, we'll take one more phone call. Calling from a 631 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, this is John from Eugene.
John from Eugene. What's on your mind?
So earlier mentioned something about Labor Secretary. I just looked this up. Abby Finkenauer is being considered by the Biden administration. I don't really know a whole lot about her background, but something stuck out to me. She's 31, has a fairly, I don't know, okay voting record, but comes from Iowa. I'm just confused why somebody like this is being considered for the position.
To be honest with you, I don't know. All I can tell you is that I think... I don't really know much about her. I know that she, you know, sort of like, I think probably there's, she flipped a seat in Iowa. I have a feeling that there's going to be some redistricting that is going to take place in Iowa. So
well, actually she, I think she lost her.
Oh, she did?
Yeah.
Oh, she may have won in 2018. And lost this time around, and maybe it's, I don't know, maybe they want to keep her in politics. I think I don't know if it's like an ag, it has implications for ag. I just don't know much about her. I'll read up on it though.
All right. Thank you for taking my call.
Appreciate the call. All right, let's take one more so we can actually call from a 215 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from? You're the final caller of the week.
Whoa.
215.
That's a hang up.
That's a lot of pressure.
Yeah. All right, hang in there.
This is Monroe. I'm calling from Philadelphia. And I just wanted to – the Democrats' messaging is so horrible that – Pelosi couldn't figure out a way to say we couldn't or couldn't figure out a way to let the stimulus go through to McConnell for fear that he would pass it, because then Trump would have gotten credit for, you know, giving out checks to people again. So they're just so terrible at messaging that the Republicans would have taken credit for it and they wouldn't have had anything to do to stop them.
I mean, I think Trump's the president. He's going to get credit for that stimulus. That's going to happen. But I think the messaging failure is like where you come out there and start saying like, oh, we just changed our mind, as opposed to like, look, the American people are hurting. And we thought that the Republican Party would have recognized that by now, and they didn't. So we need to get whatever we can to the American public now. And if I am guilty of imparting too much decency to Mitch McConnell, then guilty. But we need to help the American public. I mean, I don't know. This is
like your case. I mean, it's not
you can
do the right thing and also do politics. It's not that hard.
I mean, does Nancy Pelosi think that by like, if I call Mitch McConnell out, that's going to be the thing that changes his mind and we're not going to get a bill? I mean, that's the failure of messaging. I think there's a legitimate concern that maybe Donald Trump would get credit, obviously, for that, but you got to do something. You got to like fill the vacuum, and they're not doing it. Appreciate the phone call.
And it's just so obvious now that the whole reason she didn't do it is because she was scared he would get credit for it. And she can't say that.
Right. Well, then come up with something else, for God's sakes. It just took me 3 seconds to do that. But right. I'm not saying that you need to do that.
Well, and the pathetic part is the answer is, well, now we have a Democratic president and the vaccine's on the way because, quote, our prayers have been answered.
Yeah.
So this is someone who is thoughts and prayersing COVID-19.
We want to thank God for stepping in and providing us with the stimulus. And
folks, and it wasn't us, because don't give us credit for anything, because we don't engage in selling ourselves to the American public. That would be beneath us. Everyone just needs to understand to vote for Democrats no matter what, no matter what we do.
Vote for God.
Here is, we'll do two more IMs and then we'll get out of here. South Dakota Progressive. My wife is a high school teacher and one of her students just got over having COVID for the third time. She, the student, tested positive in March, August, and November. She said the third time was significantly worse than the first two times, which were mild. School district does not mandate masks for students or staff, but recently gave teachers an $800 please don't complain bonus.
Wow.
Is that in South Dakota? Oh, my God. That's just insanity. Francesca, thank you so much. Great job today.
Thanks for having me, Sam. Brandon,
Matt. Emma, great job. Final IM of the day. Hey, MR crew, it's my birthday today, and all I want is a Dem win in Georgia, but I'd settle for a shofar. You got it. Also, I'm heading back to grad school, and I'm pondering a thesis topic involving Michael's work and vision. Might we connect in the relatively near future? Of course. All right, folks, have a great weekend. Guys, thanks again. See you on Monday.
Take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm gonna get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. But finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, the Mets are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that bends before it finally breaks you. I guess I'm where I lost the drive between the 101.